Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
Hi, this is Brian Elias, president of 1-800-Hansons. Need new windows, siding, roofing, doors, or gutter protection, but not quite ready to buy? Well, click on the banner above and enter my exciting home makeover sweepstakes. You could win the home improvement of your dreams. Come on, get it done.
Or even the 2007 Chevy Tahoe.
Go to Nicorette.com for official rules.
If you want to beat smoking, it's a long race. Win the battle one craving at a time with Nicorette.
Use as directed. Follow dosing schedule. Individual results may vary. Support program can improve success rate. No purchase necessary to enter. Sweepstakes starts September 24th and ends December 31st.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome to the broadcast, everybody. Hello, Detroit! I said, hello, Detroit! I'm not getting any answer here. I think everyone's watching the World Series. Tigers up 3-0, eighth inning. Cardinals at bat. Another one of these big rematch. I love one of these. It's these traditional teams. You know, sometimes I hear these World Series, and I don't pay any attention to them then. I don't pay any attention to the games in any of the sports where they've got teams that have just kind of come up in the last 10 years or something like that. Like I'm listening to some game, and I'm thinking, wait a minute. A baseball team is playing a football team or something like that, or a hockey team from Florida. Nah, it doesn't work with me. Any event, Tigers winning 3-0 game 2 of the World Series. Last time the Tigers played the St. Louis Cardinals, 1968. They won before that, 1945, wasn't it? They lost, yeah. So there's an old tradition here. And, all right, I never have the television on because it totally distracts me. But if you're listening in Detroit, in fact, I guess it's going to go to all you people listening around the country and around the world. You can still call in to 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. And welcome back to the Waking Up Store, because Night Call this hour brought to you by Waking Up, Metro Detroit's sweatshop-free clothing store. It's located in the Universal Mall at 12 Mile Road in DeQuinder and Warren. You can go online and check them out, wakingupstore.com. And let's see, you can email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Call Talk Yes, but call in, 313-298-WRIF. You know, I can't even tell you what night this is on. Maybe Wednesday, I think it says here. There's this reality show, a dance contest called Dancing with the Stars. So my wife watches that, and I do something else. I watch a video. I do stuff on the computer. I read. And every once in a while, she says, you got to see this. You got to see these people dance. And you know, they're pretty cool dancers. But it's a lot, you know, like all those kind of shows, there's a lot more going on than that. And she's really into it, and so are, I guess, 18 million other people. But here's a little wrinkle to it, part of which you may have heard already. They have people from what they do, in case you don't know, is they pair up a professional dance teacher with someone in another aspect of sports or show business or something like that. And they have really danced before, so they teach them how to dance. Some of these people are absolutely astounding, like the people that won last time. I can't remember who the hell it was, but they were pretty incredible. I mean, I do go there, and I love my wife, and when she says, come in and watch these people dance, I do, because they're good. And sometimes they have people on there that cannot dance at all. It's really, they had a father of a rapper, like, I don't know when that was, 6 months ago or something like that, and he could not dance worth a damn, and the deal was that they have these judges, and I guess they always have on these reality shows where they have judging people, like in, what's that one I've never seen, American Idol, that they have these really mean judges. And so I guess they got some, I mean, they just tell these people straight, you can't dance. But then they allow the viewers to vote as well. So some of these people that can't dance worth a lick, they stay on. One of them is Jerry Springer. Now, Jerry Springer is best known, of course, for this insane television show where people talk about how they slept with their mother or something like that. And they always get in fights, and you know, they got to bleep out what they say. And but Springer, as many of you know, was like the mayor of Cincinnati. And he's got political aspirations, and right now he's a talk show host on the Air America radio network. So he's also a liberal talk show host, as well as this idiotic show. The only time I ever saw that show, the one where people fight, I blew my finger out of joint playing handball, and I was in the emergency room in Detroit receiving. And so I was in there, and then they were showing, must have been a rerun because it was at night, and people were all jumping out of their seats and screaming because this big brawl started on the set. Well, whatever. So Dancing with the Stars is going on. It's the highest rating reality show on television this fall. Well, it turns out that there is this country and western star, Sarah Evans. Never heard of her before because I just don't pay any attention to that music at all. But she dropped out about a week ago or so and filed for a divorce from her husband, who she's been married to for 13 years. And she filed for divorce in a state court in Tennessee, and from her husband, Craig Shelsky. That's it. Shelsky. And guess what? He's a Republican fundraiser, right? Family values and all that. These guys are packing more lawsuits and indictments and what have you. I mean, it's just absolutely amazing. In unusually explicit court papers, it says here in the New York Times of October 17th, Ms. Evans accused her husband of adultery with the couple's former nanny, excessive drinking, soliciting sex via an internet site, and maintaining a library of pornography that included pictures of him having sex with the other woman. I love this. I love it. Right? Typical Republican. Hypocrite. Right, talking about family values and all that, all the while just down and dirty. And says in this account, said Mr. Shelsky, 43, could not be reached for comment. But actually, since then, he did. He did make a comment. He said none of this was true, and he accused Sarah Evans, his wife, of having an affair. Now, they're filming this out in Hollywood, and the couple's kids are out there while all this is going on publicly. So a lot of this you probably know. Why am I going into all this? Because it has this very odd little typical wrinkle. Tom DeLay, who many of you may remember because these corrupt, vile characters from the Republican Party that get indicted and they quit Congress and you never hear from again. But Tom DeLay, this is an interesting lesson in reading the newspapers as well. Although Sarah Evans was only one of the 11 celebrity contestants who began the season, each paired with a professional ballroom dancer for training and competition, Ms. Evans attracted more than the usual amount of attention. Tom DeLay. Now, some of you probably remember him. Some of you may not know who the hell he is. I'll tell you in a second. It says here, Tom DeLay, the former United States congressman and Republican leader from Texas, recently sent out a mass email message asking supporters to watch the show and vote for Ms. Evans, whom he called, quote, a good friend of mine, country music singer, and GOP supporter. Now, what's wrong here? Well, very few of you probably have actually ever taken part in professional journalism. I've done some of that. And you write, and then who's the last person to see it? An editor. And they make sure that it's up to standards. And one of the things that you want to do is you want to inform your readers, or if you think even if they're already informed, you want to remind them about all the information in there. Because, if you're talking about the World Series, you at some line in there, you say that it's the Tigers and the St. Louis Cards, and it's game two and what have you. But DeLay is, in fact, a former United States congressman and Republican leader from Texas. But he's a little more than that. He resigned because he was indicted for corruption. And he is a Republican leader that gerrymandered. That means squiggling the boundaries of congressional districts around so that it ensures Republican victories. So this guy is corrupt to the core, and he's saying that they should watch the show and vote for Sarah Evans. He says that Ms. Evans, quote, represents good American values in the media. Now, this was before her husband accused her of having an affair, and before she accused her husband of adultery with the couple's former nanny, excessive drinking, soliciting sex via an internet site, and maintaining a library of pornography that included pictures of him having sex with other women. I don't know what he thought after that. But let's see. He noted that one of her opponents in the competition was, quote, ultra-liberal talk show host Jerry Springer. DeLay added, we need to send a message to Hollywood and the media that smut has no place on television by supporting good people like Sarah Evans. I mean, these people are such a piece of work. I mean, they are hypocrites with a big capital H. See, if you don't paint this picture of yourself that is so self-righteous and no room for mistakes. Well, all right, let me just stick with this story. In the divorce filing, she says that Shelsky, her husband, is unemployed, but he's listed online as the chairman of CRAIGPAC, a political action committee dedicated to electing Republicans in state and national races. And he's got his work cut out for him, but he's sort of typical of many of the candidates, isn't he? Shelsky, who ran unsuccessfully in 2002 for the Republican nomination for the 5th Congressional District in Oregon, is also listed online as the executive director of American Destiny, a nonprofit organization that promotes the role of religion in the founding of the United States. Yeah, American Destiny, a nonprofit organization that promotes the role of religion in the founding of the United States. So he's doing that when he's not screwing his nanny, drinking excessively, soliciting sex via an internet site, and maintaining a library of pornography that included pictures of him having sex with that woman. Now, he denies it. So that's an allegation. But I mentioned this last week. That I have, and it's on my site, Peter Werbe, P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com, that I have this nine-page document, single space, of Republicans who have committed sex crimes. Republican activist Lawrence King organized child sex parties at the White House during the 1980s. Republican lobbyist Craig J. Spence organized child sex parties. Oh, same guy. Same deal. I mean, not same guy, same parties. Republican racist pedophile in New York and United States Senator Strom Thurmond had sex with a 15-year-old black girl, which produced a child. Republican pastor Mike Hintz, whom George W. Bush commended during the 2004 presidential campaign, surrendered to police after admitting to a sexual affair with a female juvenile. And this is on and on and on. This is illegal stuff, folks. I mean, you could fill another book with the sex that they had outside of marriage. And men do this. Powerful men do this. Power is an aphrodisiac. It's not even that so much. But a lot of women feel, well, they can advance their career. They can't say no. I mean, it's pretty slimy. I mean, just like, you know, what Clinton did was pretty slimy, even if it was consenting adults. But you're not going to fill enormous books filled with books full of information with pedophilia. So the GOP, which generally stands for the Grand Old Party, is actually the greedy, obtuse pedophiles. They're serial sexual criminals, among all the other things that typify them. But why can't I bring the thing that I bring every time and haul it out? Where is it? I mean, I know it by memory. Where is it? But let's go back one more time. And I my apologies to some of you who have heard. Oh, yeah, here it is. It's called the Bill of Rights. But let's go back to this great American Republican, Mr. Shelsky, who is the executive director of American Destiny, a nonprofit organization that promotes the role of religion in the founding of the United States. Most of these things are simply rackets. You know, that that they get money from rich right-wing Republicans, that promotes the role of religion in the founding of the United States. You know what the founding of the role of religion in the founding of the United States was? Zero, zero, nothing, nada, not a damn thing. These people make this up. I shall read to you once again from the First Amendment, and I tell people, hey, by the way, you want to join the conversation? Is anybody out there from Detroit? Is everybody just watching the World Series? What you should do, I mean, have it on. And, like, commercials are on now on television. I have the monitor on. And then during the commercials, you can listen and call. 313-298-WRIF. Hey, I'm actually begging, aren't I? I never do that, but Detroit's wild with the World Series, and understandably. 313-298-9743. All right, so one more time. Where is Mr. Sanctimonious here? Oh, yeah, right below my hand here. So here is Sarah Evans' husband that's accused of adultery, excessive drinking, soliciting sex, and having a pornography collection online. But he is the executive director of American Destiny, a nonprofit organization promoting the role of religion in the founding of the U.S. Amendment number one, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. No law respecting an establishment of religion. Of all the things they were concerned with, the right to bear arms, oh yeah, that's number two, but free speech, the right to exercise religion freely, free press, the right of people to peacefully assemble. In other words, you can get out and demonstrate. You can petition the government for redress of grievances. All people should be secure in their homes. You have a right to a speedy trial. I'm not doing all of them. You know, like quartering the soldiers in our homes isn't a big issue anymore. On and on. No cruel and unusual punishments. On and on and on. The very first thing the Founding Fathers knew was that Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. They were so suspicious of organized religion that that was number one. Not even a right. I mean, you know, that these gun folks say that the Second Amendment is what everything is based on. I mean, we could talk about that forever, but that's not the first thing that they put in there. First thing that the Founding Fathers put in there was Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. That's how important they saw it. So hypocrites. Greedy, obtuse pedophiles, the GOP, serial sexual criminals. That's what they are. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Debating what to do. I think what I'm going to do is grab my little mouse, which isn't where it's supposed to be, and go right to our phones. Phones are three. I told you that, didn't I? I guess I'll tell you who I am. Peter Werby and hi, Ginger from Waterford. You're on the air. How you doing?
Hello, this is Ginger.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, I just think it's ridiculous how, you know, it's like Republicans, they always have something to say about family values, but when it comes down to it, I mean, they're the ones with the most skeletons in their closet, you know?
What's up with them?
I don't know. It's just, I mean, this happened back in 92. Remember the family value things that was happening back then? And now all of a sudden it's like coming back, and especially with this dance program and stuff like that, it's almost on the news every night. And especially now that voting and everything's going on and it's getting that time. And
yeah, well,
it's all about let's be family values and let's be church.
Well, back when Clinton was having all his problems, turned out that these Republicans, well, they were just in, you know, like Newt Gingrich, and then they were going to, he had to step down, and they replaced him with this guy, I think it was Livingston or something from Louisiana. And he was having an affair just like Newt Gingrich. So they are like the biggest hypocrites in the whole world. But one of the things about liberals are just people that have a tolerance or people that aren't busybodies and aren't in other people's lives. You know, we're not making any claims of being next to God, and we're not making claims about being godly or anything like that. But if you are, like all these preachers that are always getting caught, you know, these right-wing preachers getting caught hanging out with prostitutes and stuff like that, you better be on your best behavior, and they never are. They're always on their worst behavior, aren't they?
Exactly, you know, and it's like, oh, I don't think person out there, but I mean, I'm not saying I'm better than what I am, and then, you know, not practicing what I preach. So I think they need to practice what they preach or just get off the pedestal.
Yeah. All right, Ginger, thank you very much. Your phone is breaking up a little. You're undoubtedly on a cell, but I thank you for calling in. Peter Werby with you on WRIF. One of the things, I already voted. I'm going to be out of town, so on election day, so I already voted. But one of the things that kind of knocked me back. Is this a Nugent deal? There's about 40 game birds in Michigan that people can plug, right? And now they want to shoot mourning doves. You know those little like pigeons, and when they coo, and when they take off, their wings make this kind of, if that's the way it sounds. But, you know, there's no dove overpopulation, and these guys just want to shoot them for target practice. They don't even eat them. They don't do any property damage. They don't hurt crops or anything like that. And, like, there is this preponderance, this incredible number of other game birds. And you know that Michigan has protected mourning doves since 1905. And so for some reason, I mean, it's kind of the Nugent type of mentality that if it moves and it's not a human or it's not a dog, they want to be able to shoot it. I don't get this mentality. I think this is going to go down to defeat big time. So I would heavily urge. I haven't been doing this. I haven't been, pounding anybody's candidacy or anything like that. Oh, there's a couple of friends of mine that are running, and we've had them on the air before. 313-298-WRIF. So vote no on proposal three. Let's go to Jody in Detroit. Jody, hi. It's Peter Werby, and you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing good. What's up?
Oh, nothing. Just sitting around listening to you. And, you know, I don't know a lot about politics. I choose not to.
Yeah?
But from what I do hear and what I do read, it just seems like we really need a new way. You know, get some humanitarians in or business people. I mean,
We have, Jody, we've got the business people in now. They're the ones that have been taking us to the cleaners. But I think, I think there's a difference. I mean, I have friends of mine that are businessmen that are decent people. But what you said, that word humanitarian, which puts the human beings and the needs of human beings before the concerns of profit and business. And some people think they're the same, but they're really not. And so what we need are people that have these deep concerns for humanity. And it's not the guys that are in there now. They are just getting every bit of loot they can, and are corrupt as hell.
Yeah, exactly. And they're all pretty rotten. But I just don't understand why people aren't really angry about this and doing something about it.
Well, I think people are, Jody. I mean, it's not like the 1960s or the 1930s or anything like that, that's for sure. But there's an anger, and you got to believe, let me see here. Just, I was looking at this poll. Two-thirds of the American people give Bush negative job marks, and Congress, job approval has gone below 20%. So 80% at least of the American people think that Congress has done a bad job. I mean, and I don't know if you got to put this in quote human terms, like we were talking about. But could you imagine if 80% of the people you knew didn't like you? That would be a pretty terrible indictment, wouldn't it?
Well, of course.
Yeah. So 80% of the people think this Congress has just been worthless. And fortunately now, too, that just 33% think that the Iraq war has been worth it. So everything that many of us have been saying for the last 5 and 6 years has finally come true, which is good. All right, get out there. Get those humanitarians in there. Thank you, Jody. Thanks for joining us at 313-298-WRIF. And let's see, I think, is Ron ready? If not, I think maybe we will we'll go to spots and be right back. In the meantime, if you'd like to call in, 313-298-WRIF. Ron is? Okay, we'll get Ron first. Ron from Algonac. Ron, hi. Peter Werby, and you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing good. What's up?
I was calling about your, you were talking about the mourning dove hunts.
Yeah.
The guys coming in and wanting to shoot up all the birds and stuff. Well, I'm an avid hunter, and I'm not trying to get all rude with you or anything, but people do eat those birds. They're very good, actually.
Well, okay, but most people don't. Most people just shoot them. And there's 40 other birds. I mean, why add another bird? I mean, these are nice little, sweet little birds. I mean, I don't think anybody's going to come on my drive and kill my
oh no
the ones
no.
That, you know, I know out in the wild.
Yeah, but Are you a hunter at all or no?
No.
Do you hunt? Have you ever hunted? Have you ever been into the outdoor scene at all or no?
Well, certainly the outdoor scene, but not hunting.
Okay.
So, well, Ron left us unceremoniously. Maybe he thought that did it. Well, you're not a hunter. You don't know what it's like to shoot little animals. We'll be right back.
This is WRIN.com.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back. 313-298-WRIF. Tigers took it 3-1. Kenny Rogers pitching eight innings of non-scoring ball. What is that? Man, I can't remember. I forgot, though, how many total he's got. Been pitching a lot of no-run ball, that's for sure. Anyway, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Call talk, yes, at yahoo.com. We're talking about killing mourning doves. That's nothing. Iceland has decided to break the global moratorium on commercial whaling, and they killed an endangered fin whale for the first time since the 1980s. Reykjavik, Iceland media showing footage of a large fin whale being towed by a whaling boat. What the hell are they doing with it? I guess some of it's used for sushi in Japan, except, that's not fish. It's a mammal. And these creatures are so incredible. I don't think I have to sell anybody on whales. But there are all these countries like Japan and even Denmark. But you think, what in the hell are these people doing? I'm just looking. I can't read all of this right now on screen. Well, let's go back to your calls right now. And let's see. I don't have much up here. I don't think our screen is doing real well. But here's Nick. Nick, welcome to the broadcast. Where are you calling from, Nick?
I live in Port Huron, but right now I'm in Detroit. How are you doing, sir?
Okay. Are you downtown?
I'm going there right now. I'm in Motor City Casino right now.
All right. Well, I don't know. It's pretty cold to party outside, but yeah. give it a whirl. What's up? What do you have to say?
I just want to let you know I'm an avid listener of yours. I don't agree with most of your opinions, but I do listen because I do like to get my opposing views, opinions on things. And so I just like to, only one thing I want to point out to you is you were saying it's a Nugent-esque way of thinking to want to kill these birds, and I've actually met Ted, and I just want to know that he's a guy who says you should never shoot anything unless you're going to eat it. So, I mean, okay, I don't agree with some things that Ted thinks, and I'm sure there's a lot of us out there that think Ted's a little bit wacky, and I'm a fan of his, and I think he's a bit nuts, but...
Yeah, do you think?
He says don't kill anything unless you're going to eat it, and I mean, okay, I don't agree with killing a lot of stuff, but that's one thing I say, you know what, if you're going to kill it and you're going to eat it, use its, skin and hide and stuff, okay, go for it, because he will not let anything go to waste, so... I don't agree with killing these mourning doves. That's just stupid. I don't care how good they taste. They're beautiful birds. They're a great creature of God. I don't know if I'm supposed to say it on air or not.
Sorry.
But to me, they're beautiful. And I do agree with you they shouldn't be killing them, but I don't agree with you saying that's a Nugent-esque way of thinking.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate it, Nick. Thanks for joining us. And, hey, it's a real pleasure. This is some good news. My pal Tony Truppiano. Tony, welcome to the broadcast.
Peter, pleasure to be with you. Great show tonight.
Well, let me tell people, Tony Truppiano is running in Michigan's 11th Congressional District. And Tony's an old pal of mine, a colleague in talk radio, you can go to what's your website now? You got a couple of them.
TonyForCongress2006.com is the one that matters to me over the next 16 days.
Okay, and you're running a hot race against Thaddeus McCotter, not exactly a household name, but down there in the 11th District. Which what cities does that take in?
Western Wayne, Southwest Oakland, Commerce Township. You had a gal from Waterford call a little earlier. We go into Waterford all the way over to Dearborn Heights, up until Belleville, and lots of points in between, Peter.
Now, usually thought of as a safe Republican district, here comes Tony Truppiano running on the Democratic Party ticket. Got a little better chance than one would have thought just by virtue of what's happening in the country. Forgetting about the strength, which we will talk about in a second, the strength of your candidacy.
Well, certainly it doesn't hurt when, and my opponent, by the way, Peter, as I think you know, is an assistant whip, which makes him a part of the leadership team. In the House, that doesn't help his cause at all either. I guess, Peter, at some gut level, as an American, as somebody that's proud to call myself an American, this the corruption and the sense of misdirection of this country and the way that we've obscured so many different things and taking away people's identities, it's just obviously time for change now.
Yeah, tell us about financing, because we find out that more and more, are you one of these millionaires is dropping millions into your own contest, Tony?
Well, I was in radio, so you already know the answer to that. No, I'm not. No, I mean, the funding part of the equation is next to impossible, and we need to find, I mean, we need to really get to get some legislation in place that transitions us towards publicly financed campaigns. I spent a disgusting amount of time trying to raise money when you really should be dialoguing with your voters. I mean, that's really what this is about. It's about connecting with people, and it shouldn't be about begging for money.
Well, to be sure. Well, tell us, people here very frequently distrustful, certainly of the gang in power, but not real thrilled about the Democrats. Why should anybody vote for Tony Truppiano in the 11th District and over a Republican, or just even get out of the House on November 7th?
Well, I can give you a list as long as my arm why we need to get out of the House, why we need change. I mean, we could talk everything from No Child Left Behind to the Iraq War. I mean, there are a lot of reasons people need to get out of their house, but you ask specifically why should they vote for me over anybody else. I believe, and again, if they go to the website, TonyForCongress2006.com, they're going to see that there are a lot of proposals that I put out there. But beyond that, Peter, I think we need to start electing people that are like us, that are hardworking middle-class people that haven't made a career out of making laws and cutting deals, people that understand what it's like to get up early in the morning and to work late at night, and know that it's sometimes tough to stretch dollars from month to month. And I think if we start electing more people like that, we're going to see a government that actually reflects the ideas that you and I care passionately about, you know, and of course that's a large list as well. I mean, better schools, safer streets, health care for everybody. You know, it's just time we take care of ourselves.
Well, Tony, do you, and I ask Nancy Skinner, who's running up in the 9th District, I said, tell me about your chances. In another year, in a different year, I would have thought you would have had a real tough struggle. I know you still do, but what do you think your chances are?
I mean, my chances are excellent. I mean, we've built an amazing operation here in the 11th Congressional District. We have over 700 volunteers. We have 304 precincts in the district. We have 285 precinct captains. We have really done, I think, an exceptional job reaching out to constituencies in Oakland County. I mean, we've crisscrossed this district. I've walked more doors, called more voters. I spent all day today on the phone just talking to voters. I think that our chances are excellent.
Do you need more people?
We always need more people, especially on election day. We will have challengers at the polls. We want to make sure, of course, that every vote counts, and we're going to do our job to make sure that that happens. But, yeah, we need more people.
All right, and tell us the website one more time.
TonyForCongress2006.com.
And I know this may be a bit of a diversion, but I would send people to your thetonyshow.com as well, because there's so much about you, and you have a, and we won't go into that right now because it's too long, but an unusual personal history that I think is extraordinarily admirable. And once they go to the one for Congress, maybe take a look at that as well.
Well, thank you, Peter. I appreciate that.
All right, Tony Truppiano, Congressman, how would that sound? Congressman Truppiano from the 11th Congressional District. I'm going to be watching Tuesday night. I'm not in that district, but I'm going to be watching it closely.
Thank you, Peter. I appreciate you giving me a few minutes tonight.
Thank you, Tony. Bye now. That's Tony Truppiano. That's T-R-U-P-I-A-N-O. Truppiano. Tony Truppiano. And actually, here's someone who is in his district. There's open lines, by the way, 313-298-WRIF. And we'll talk about voting. You know, one of these far-right-wing conservatives, they are so desperate. They're telling Democrats not to vote. Telling them not to vote on right-wing shows, telling them to stay home. Here's Marion in Dearborn Heights. And, Marion, you're in Tony Truppiano's district.
Well, I'll definitely be voting for Tony, Peter.
Good.
I was wondering, I called Debbie Stabenow's office the other day and, you know, wanted to know why she voted for this detainee detention bill. And I spoke to a representative of hers, and she said they'd be sending something in the mail to everybody who calls and asks why. Well, I'm still waiting. And I'd like to know, is there anything, is this bill for an indefinite period, this law, or is it,
this is,
can it be ameliorated in any kind of way by anybody, or is it going to stand for all time?
No, and let me just make sure that everybody knows the law we're talking about. This is the Military Commissions Act that essentially alters fundamental international law and domestic law. It abolishes the right of habeas corpus. It means that people that are being held by the United States that have been designated by the president as enemy combatants have no recourse to legal review. This is unheard of. This is exactly, we were talking earlier about the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. This is the kind of laws that the founding fathers revolted against and put into place a document that would prohibit that for American citizens. You say, oh, they're terrorists. Well, we don't even know if they're terrorists, because if there's no way to give them review, if there's no way to find out whether information has been tortured out of them, in fact, it does allow torture. So it's called a torture bill. Debbie Stabenow, a liberal Democrat, voted for that. But she also voted for the Flag Amendment. She also voted to build that wall across the southern border. She voted for the bankruptcy bill. I mean, might as well have Bouchard in there, the Oakland County Sheriff. I mean, he'll vote like that, too. What's the diff?
She's a Democrat in Republicans' clothing, or whatever. You
yeah,
know
but
I mean.
But Marion, I suspect you will get a letter, because I know someone else who got one. And she was explaining why she voted for this torture bill. And it was such cockamamie logic that, you read things and you read it over and you go, what the hell did she say? Well, that's usually a tip-off that it's BS, because...
political expediency.
Yeah, yeah. She did not want... Here, I mean, she knew that it was going to win. So she figured this is pure political opportunism. It's not like she believed in this, because she voted against, to her credit and to the credit of our state of Michigan, she, along with Carl Levin, voted against the Iraq War resolution. And, of course, she's been justified in her opposition to the war. But Senator Levin from Michigan voted against this torture bill. But she did not want to have Bouchard have, you know, airing, this is what she anticipated, airing ads that said, Debbie Stabenow voted for terrorism. You know, that kind of stuff. Those attack ads. But that, you know what that says? She does not have confidence in the intelligence of her constituents, that she cannot take a principled stand and make us understand it. So my respect for her is plummeted.
I was very disappointed, to say the least.
Yeah. Well, Marion, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Let me know if you get the letter from Debbie.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye now. Open lines for you at 313-298-WRIF. How come? Yeah, there you go. I press these little buttons, and they don't always respond. Let me see in here. Yeah, all right. This is what I was looking for. I was talking about this earlier, about the polls, how job approval for Congress has dropped below 20%. I mean, this is a disaster for a sitting party. Now, if this was a country like Canada or Britain, the conservatives in this country, the elected politicians, would disappear, as they did for quite a while in Canada, and they did for quite a while in Britain. But because of the way that money rules, and of course tens of millions, maybe even hundreds of millions, are the Republicans are able to garner through these corporations. Although, you know, they start giving it to the Democrats too. They go, whoa, these guys might win. But also the way that partly the way the Constitution is structured, because the majority of people, the vote, I don't know if I can say this simply, but a lot of small states are conservative, so that Wyoming gets two senators and Michigan gets two senators, although Detroit is bigger than the population in the entire state of Wyoming. So the Democratic senators and the Democratic Congress people, they represent millions of more people, even though they're in the minority. I am going to say this confusingly. Let me try it the other way. The Republicans have the majority in both houses, although the Democratic representatives and the Democratic senators represent millions and millions of more people. Does that make sense? It's the way that everything is structured. And for instance, I don't have this in front of me, but there is this Republican in West Virginia, and West Virginia is a Democratic stronghold, and people are usually running, maybe the way they should, like with $50,000 in their campaigns. So they got this rich Republican that's dumping in like $18 million in order to to twist the election by money. What did Bob Dylan say? Money doesn't talk, it swears, right? So anyway, the Republican Congress, the approval rating below 20%, Bush below 40%. He got up to 42%, and now it's back down to 37%. This is according to Zogby International. Bush was last at 37 positive job approval, and 63% of us give Bush negative job marks. Well, gee. And only a third of the people think the Iraq war is worth it. Well, geez, I mean, what more? You know, actually, let me go to that. This might be a good time to do that. Did you see this, by the way? A senior U.S. diplomat. That's our guy, right? A senior U.S. diplomat, he's appointed by Bush and everything, said the United States had shown, quote, arrogance and stupidity in Iraq, but was now ready to talk with any group except al-Qaeda in Iraq to facilitate national reconciliation. Do you get all that? He said, we'll talk with these insurgents because they're referred to as the enemy. These are the people that are now have the U.S. Casualty list up to 80 something. Is it what, 88 or 80? Is it just at 80? I can't remember. But I mean, these are people that that Bush sent over from our country to fight these irregular militiamen and insurgents, resistance fighters that do not want our sons and daughters and brothers and husbands over there. They're not from a foreign country. They are from Iraq. There are Iraqis who do not want Americans there. And maybe they didn't like Saddam Hussein at all. Maybe they did. But things have gotten tremendously worse. And now, not only do you have everything that the critics of the war said all along, and let me just give another pitch, I say repeating myself, that the critics are almost always right in American history. I would go so far as to say always right. And when it sometimes takes 30 years, but a lot of you are living in a period where we learned this in a couple of years. And some of you who are like, I don't know, 18 years old, this stuff's going to be hidden for a while. But within your lifetime, you're going to find out that everything that people said about Bushco, the racket ruling us now, was absolutely true. When all the papers come out and all the, you know, these guys will be in their 80s and they start writing their memoirs and all, they go, gee, yeah, you know, why did I believe them? Why did I believe them? But now, here, the senior official, Alberto Fernandez, who is director of public diplomacy in the Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs at the State Department, offered this unusually candid assessment of America's war in Iraq. He said that the United States had shown arrogance and stupidity in Iraq. Arrogance and stupidity in Iraq. So what are the consequences of the arrogance and stupidity? He meant once the United States invaded and occupied it. He's not talking about the whole set of lies that most of us believe motivated Bushco and the others, all this stuff about weapons of mass destruction. He's talking once they're there that it was the whole occupation essentially was marked by arrogance and stupidity. Well, so far, according to Johns Hopkins research, there's been 654,000 deaths that have been tied to the Iraq war. So the idea that in any way people are better off than they were under Saddam Hussein is insane. This country is absolutely destroyed. Do I have to really make a big pitch for that? I mean, if you see it all on television, you know that. 654,000, and this is this pile of corpses of civilians is at the hands of George W. Bush. The instrument of it is our troops that he sent over to do this. It'd be like 7.5 million Americans dead in the United States. Also, now the United Nations says that almost 1 million Iraqis have had to flee their homes. And so what do we get out of here from Alberto Fernandez that says arrogance and stupidity has marked the occupation of Iraq? Oh, sorry about that. Sorry that we killed 654,000 of you. Sorry that we've driven a million of you from your homes. I mean, it's all not the United States, and all these deaths aren't at the hands of the United States. In fact, a greater increasing proportion of them are Iraqi against Iraqi. But these are the forces that were set in motion. And now the Army says that troops are going to stay in Iraq till 2010. And did I tell you this last week? Because in the war budget of hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars, there's a lump sum of $20 million that's to pay for a celebration in Washington for commemoration of victory in Iraq. $20 million. Think about your local school. Think about your roads. Think about teachers that we need. Think about how many first responders that we need. Think about how many people have been laid off and all that. And this racket, Pushco, is designating $20 million for a victory celebration. This sounds like a fascist regime to me. Meantime, pagans are suing to have their emblems on graves of the American soldiers that have died that are pagans. They won't allow that right now. You can do almost anything else. Where I saw it somewhere in here, you know, for the Wiccans, for instance, can't do it. They don't want to do it. You can. I thought they had this list in here of almost. Oh yeah, you can have Buddhism, Judaism, Christianity, of course, Islam, Sikhs, Hinduism, and even atheism. If you're an atheist in a foxhole, it's represented by an atom with an A inside. That sounds like anarchism, doesn't it? Circle A and all that. 38 religious symbols at all, but you can't do Wicca. Let's go back to our phones. 313-298-WRIF. 313-298-9743. Here's Joe in Hamtramck. Joe, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter, how you doing? Listen to you every Sunday night.
Well, thank you, Joe.
A couple good things, you know. We are in election year, and I'm a former politician from the city of Hamtramck, city councilman. We speak 38 languages in our high school. And I'll tell you, we've got diversity there. But being with this election year, this Bush-O-Matic stuff that's going on, we don't need it.
Bush-O-Matic, I love it. I'm going to steal it.
Bush-O-Matic, you know, it's control the gas, control everything. It's tough. It's hard for people to win an election.
Yeah.
You got a guy like Dick DeVos spending $60 million to tell you he's going to work for free. He's working for power.
Uh-huh.
And that's the bottom line. He wants to work for power.
Well, going back to that $20 million that Bush wants, or is in the budget, for a victory celebration, you think Hamtramck has any needs that maybe they need $20 million to put the city back in shape again? Think that might be a little better there?
Yeah, you're thinking we go to roads, schools, things that we need, infrastructure.
Yeah, yeah.
Most definitely. But like I said, that Bush-O-Matic, it's kind of hard to beat these guys with all the cheese. They got all the money.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. Well, I don't know what's going to happen, but we shall see what we shall see. Joe, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it, particularly with someone having experience in a city that desperately needs funds, and we're just giving it away down this rat hole to war and Halliburton. Damn. All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. I push these little buttons, nothing happens here. What is going on with that? Well, here's Ken. You're not supposed to do this. He says, I find hunting mourning doves fun. I love to kill those little birds. That's what I'm saying. And I do eat them. Their breasts are just like chicken nuggets. My daughter, she's 14, and I love going out in the mornings and evening to hunt with our dogs. We do not have anything we do not eat, and anybody that does not is a real hunter. They're just killers. You of all people should know better than lumping a group of people together. Not everybody is the same. That's true. I agree with you, Ken. There is a lot of slob hunters. In many ways, I don't want to hear from a lot of hunters. I find it kind of a strange hobby. You know? I mean, I don't eat meat. And my thing is I will, and I don't eat fowl. I will eat anything I will kill, which is fish. Now, fish are animals. So you can think, what's the difference between a fish and a chicken? I don't even know. I can't even come up with an answer. But You know, guys I know, friends of mine, that go out, shoot deer, skin them, pull their guts out, you know, hang them to age and all that. I think, you know, Gaia bless you. You know, you're right in there. I have a lot more respect for those people than that when someone's gone, oh, God, that's sickening. Oh, that makes me sick. Pulling their guts out and cutting their heads off and, ah. And by the way, I'm going to the market and buy some ground meat, right? And then if you tell them where ground meat came from, they go, oh, that makes me sick. Well, it makes you sick. Don't eat it. So I don't know. I'm sort of mixed on that. But listen, there's enough things to shoot. And it's sort of odd that you can go out and do it. Ken and his daughter are doing it. You know, I guess it's illegal to kill mourning doves. And, you know, by the way, you know, hunters, they're always like sort of privileged. There are tens of millions of more bird watchers in America than there are hunters. But hunters are big business, and for states like Michigan, Wisconsin, actually all of them up here, in, you know, in fact, most states. So I don't want to get into a thing about hunting. I don't care. All right. Let's do this. In fact, we'll take a break. 313-298-WRIF.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, One Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
It's not sane. I just want someone to
WRIF.com.
WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back to our second hour. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. 313-298-9743. Call talkyes at yahoo.com. Email coming in fast and furious about Senator Debbie Stabenow's vote for the torture bill that would give Bush the right, well, already has, to suspend habeas corpus, one of the fundamentals. This goes way back before the U.S. Constitution, folks. This goes back to the Magna Carta in the 13th century. By the way, this hour, Night Call, brought to you by Waking Up, Metro Detroit Sweatshop Free Clothing Store. It's located in the Universal Mall at 12 Mile Road in DeQuinder in Warren and at WakingUpStore.com. They also, among other things, they have a lot of magazines and books that carry the Fifth Estate newspaper. Many of you remember that from way back when, right? Let me see. Oh, yeah. At 1 a.m. Eastern Time, and if you're elsewhere on the planet, you can do the math. 1 a.m. Eastern Time translates into wherever you are. First interview is going to be with Scott Ritter. Scott Ritter, R-I-T-T-E-R, is a conservative Republican who voted for Bush in 2000. He was on the United Nations Weapons Inspection Team during the Gulf War, and up till 1998, he was an aide to General Norman Schwarzkopf, the military general in charge of the first Gulf War, and a lot of other creds like that. And of course, he thinks that Bush is a liar and forced a war that was absolutely unnecessary based on lies. But what? I was going to say, oh, yeah, one of the things he's going to answer. Many of you believe that there's going to be what's called an October surprise with Bush and the Republicans' ratings in the toilet, that they're going to pull what's called an October surprise, pull something out of the hat. Like Osama bin Laden. Watch. That's the only thing I can imagine. They'll pull Osama bin Laden out. Hey, we got him! And then spend that $20 million that they have for the victory celebration. But so Ritter will answer the question, is an attack on Iran going to be what Bushko is going to try to pull the elections out with? Anyway, about Debbie Stabenow, Tom writes in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I let her know that I was disappointed with her vote via email and only got a generic mishmash reply. My impression of her is that she just tries to cover herself in case the country stays on the fascist fast track. I've taken a job with an advertising company driving a mobile exhibit, but I am securing my absentee ballot tomorrow. I need to get a laptop so I can keep up with your show. And this is iPodded, by the way. If you miss any of this or you want to hear yourself, and it's also archived, you can go to WhiteRoseSociety.org or for the iPod, WRIF.com. Should be on there by Wednesday. And what else? Oh, yeah, here. This is a longer letter, but just this is funny. Jeff says, are you getting ready for Night Call? I've been a listener of yours on and off since I was 8 years old. I love it. Fred writes in, here's the Stabenow letter you were talking about. I wrote her and asked her not to support the torture bill. And then she writes in, the proposal puts in place protections that do not exist today for detainees and is a better system than the one proposed by the president. This is absolute rubbish. This is absolute rubbish. Kim in Dearborn Heights writes, like Miriam, I'm in Tony Trupiano's district, the 11th, and who Tony Trupiano was on the air a little earlier. He's running against Thaddeus, there you go, McCotter. She's committed to volunteering to knock on doors on Tony's behalf. McCotter has got to go, she says. At a public forum recently, he actually gave a thumbs down to the proposed Department of Peace, derisively calling it a secular project. Whoa, can't have that. Got to have a Department of War. He's one of the fascist of this fascist cabal aided by spineless Dems like Stabenow. Boy, she's getting just what she deserves. Please urge listeners to read the profile of Dick DeVos that was published this week in Street Cred magazine. I have to say, I'm not very familiar with that. If you go to my website, peterwerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E.com, you can find all that information. Go to Street Cred as well, but maybe somebody can tell me about it. Sorry if I... People go, well, man, come on, get hip. Or if it's your magazine, you're thinking, oh, you dealt us a low blow. But my website, all the information about DeVos is there, including the Metro Times article, You Don't Know Dick, right? And Kim says, people need to know that DeVos's brother-in-law is the CEO of Blackwater Mercenaries. They're one of the groups. Maybe she says it, the ultimate war profiteer. Blackwater is, that they're making a fortune off of this war, where the men and women we send over there, they have to fight for pitiful wages. But Blackwater mercenaries, these guys get paid like, what, $125,000 a year. The piece that she's talking about really exposes the racist and fascist connection DeVos has with the far right and details the cultishness of Amway. We talked about Amway last night. All right, let's go back to our phone, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Here's Jeff. Jeff's in Windsor. Thanks for making this show international. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Pete?
Doing good.
You and I go back a way long time.
Do it.
Back to your old pal Pete days.
Oh, you do. Yeah.
Now I can get you out the White Rose Society so I can hear you like Mondays or Tuesday nights now.
Sure.
Which is really perfect, eh?
Big shout out to those folks. They're doing a wonderful job.
Yeah, they do. They spawned like a whole new podcast. Yeah, I got all kinds of shows just right around your way of thinking, your ideas. None of this, the right-wing stuff.
Yeah.
And another thing about Deb Stabenow, she seems like to be a lady that's like everybody else. More or less down the center of the road. You got some lefties, you got some real righties, but she seems to be more down the center, if anything.
Well, that's probably what her consultants told her to do, you know?
Okay. Now, there's this, I just read an article in the Times where debt is keeping troops from going overseas.
Thousands of our troops cannot be sent to Iraq because they don't have a security clearance because they have too high a debt.
Well, isn't that perfect?
I mean,
get yourself a job or a college education, buy yourself a house and a car, and not have to worry about going overseas now.
Yeah.
That's perfect. It's not perfect, but you know what I mean. I can't believe that.
Jeff, let me just explain this a little more. I mean, I was thinking, I must be as cynical as you are, because here's the deal. If you run up a debt that is, they had some little formula there that's too high, they won't send you to Iraq. Because they're afraid that you would be subjected, you could be possibly subjected to blackmail or commit treason. I mean, if you owe like $50,000 on your credit card, they're afraid that you're going to commit treason. But so there's something. Do you remember what the figure was, Jeff? 7,000, 9,000, something like that.
6,300.
Was that it? Okay.
6,300 troops?
Yeah, I thought it was, but okay, that's enough. So there's 6,300 troops, and I figured out what you could do. You get in there, you run up this credit card debt, like Jeff is saying, and then you don't get sent to harm's way. You've got all these goodies. Wow.
All you got to do is stop those payday places from setting up shop in front of your base, get them, like, you know, 100 miles away, and then you're free, right?
Right.
You got to travel 100 miles to collect your paycheck.
You got it. Thank you, Jeff. I appreciate it. Here's Mark in Westland. Mark, hi. Peter Werbe, you're on the air.
Pete, long-time listener, second-time caller.
Welcome.
Occasionally I listen to the right-wing guys, and they are freaking out.
They are.
And what is this deal with Nancy Pelosi? Why are they ganging up on her? I mean, look who they had before her. I mean, you know, the previous leaders.
You mean in the Democratic Party?
No, in the Republican Party.
Oh, well.
DeLay and all those other losers.
Yeah, that had to resign, and they're indicted, and... yeah, and actually, there's been a good history. What, you know, there's a man. He was from Macomb County. What the hell was his name? I know him. I hope he's not listening. Who was the, I guess he wasn't the Speaker of the House, but I guess I think he was a Democratic, leader there. In fact, I keep meaning to have him. I just saw him I saw him at the Labor Day parade, and I told him I was going to have him as a guest on my show. All I got to do is remember his name, right?
Right.
Yeah.
It's so funny. Some of these guys freak out.
Well, one of them, I'm actually averse to even mentioning their names.
Right.
But one of them was, let me see if I can, do I have my website up here? Yeah, here. I can get to this real quickly. He said to Democrats, stay home on election day for the sake of the nation. He's trying to restrict the vote, if you can imagine this. So, I mean, I can imagine it real easily.
That sounds like him.
Well, they don't want people voting. A lot of states are making it harder to vote because who that turns away are potential Democratic Party voters.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And what's up with Air America? I mean, are they going to make it, I hope?
Well, let me say that that's a network that has nothing to do with this station.
Right.
Probably inappropriate to talk about.
Oh, well, sorry about that.
No problem. But
thank
you.
Thanks, Pete.
All right. Bye-bye. All right. Yeah, the state's making it harder. How come? Why can't I disconnect here? I can't understand that. Describing their findings here, some states have enacted laws that make it harder to vote instead of correcting ballot problems that have plagued various parts of the country since the 2000 election. Huh. How strange. I wonder who that's benefiting. These people, these right-wingers, these conservatives, they talk about democracy and they have no commitment to it whatsoever. By the way, talking about right-wing talk radio, they've got a huge audience. I think about 30 million people, did I see this at the end of this? You know, that's like all of them. Because they can't think for themselves, and they're in this polemic against reality, so they need these characters that dominate right-wing talk radio to tell them what's what. We have a good conversation, but most of you, I mean, some of you say that, gee, I didn't know this information, and I do a lot of work on this, so I might have a little bit of information that you may not have, but a lot of you have information that I don't have. And a lot of the stuff on my website comes from you. I mean, I depend on you guys, men and women, to tip me to stuff. But those right-wingers, I've said this before, right-wing callers and right-wing shows bring zero to the show because it's just their fascistic mentality. It is just this, they're in awe of the leader. They're ditto heads. Can you imagine some liberal or leftist or progressive person being called a ditto head? Someone that is so slavish to someone on the air? I mean, isn't that just repellent on the face of it? Isn't it absolutely repellent? But Bush, and he should be, pretty worried about the elections, he brought in about eight of the big-shot right-wing talk show hosts for a four-hour meeting. I'm sorry, hour and a half. He brought in all these right-wingers, all these multimillionaire talk show hosts that make jillions of dollars. And think about this. This is an official administrative office of the United States government. Yet, they turned it into a party headquarters. All of this, the light bills are being paid by you and I there. The staff is being paid. This is all out of our tax dollars, right? Like everything is. Everything about it was, I won't name all the stuff that's going on. They had a little lunch there, a little bit to eat. We paid for that. We paid to feed these right-wing millionaire talk show hosts. So Bush could get them in the office and tell them the talking points. Because some of them were actually starting to say, you know, maybe this isn't working so well on any number of different fronts, from immigration to the economy to the war in Iraq. I mean, even these right-wingers are thinking, you know, things aren't going real well in Iraq. You know, smart guys, huh? So this is the kind of stuff that goes on. So the White House and the Republican National Committee are hammering home that point. Which point is that? When conservatives are agitated, the president, radio hosts feel pressured to stand with conservatives against the president to prove their independence. So he reeled them in. But he reeled them in on our time. We're paying his salary. I mean, why doesn't he take all the liberal talk show hosts as well? I mean, he's not going to get in the same room with them. But this is absolutely inappropriate for him to do this. He's turned this into a 100% racket. Let me see if there's, I thought there was some other stuff in here. Oh, yeah. On October 24th, so what is that, Tuesday, the administration's going to hold something of a talk show summit meeting, inviting dozens of hosts to set up booths on the White House grounds where top cabinet officials are expected to sit for interviews. And you know, I looked in my mailbox today, and guess what? They must have overlooked me, because they didn't invite me down there to set up my little booth. Now, what does that mean? He is taking the White House, and instead of being the central administrative office of the United States government, he's turned it into Republican Party headquarters on our dime. This guy has got to go. He can't be allowed to stay in office till January 20th, 2009. How about this? I will mention the name. Rush Limbaugh. His last contract got $750 million. He's a billion-dollar jaw. He said that he met with Mr. Bush and Karl Rove, the president's chief strategist, in the Oval Office in June, but generally tried to keep his distance to maintain independence. Oh, man. All right. Let's see. Let's go to Martin. Martin's in Detroit. Martin, hi.
Hi there. Now we have to think about the youth vote. I saw the movie Jesus Camp.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm trying to figure out the connection between the body of the movie and Mike Papantonio's interesting conversations. There was actually quite a wide disconnect. Now, I've worked with homeschool parents. I know that there are not very many liberals among them. I also know that within the Christian faith, there are a lot of military metaphors, fight the good fight, you know, and put on the full armor of God that you may be able to withstand the wiles of the devil. And I got to appreciate, you know, because I'm in the culture, I understand it. And I also know, for example, when they talk about giving your lives for Jesus, they can be referred to a seminal event in the 50s, late 50s, when a couple of missionaries were killed in Ecuador and spawned a whole new generation of missionaries to South America and around the world. So I think to look at the kid in the camis, bottoms, and the war paint and waving a stick.
Wait a minute, Martin. You know, everybody doesn't know what you're talking about. Martin is talking about these kids in this film, Jesus Camp, this evangelical camp that
right.
Kids are sent off to South Dakota to learn to be warriors for the Lord. And they don't seem to mind it. Most of the evangelicals that are in the film think it's great. People like myself, I mean, I'm just horrified by it all. And they, at one point, they are, in war paint.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's, again, in the Christian faith, there is a war metaphor, word picture that's used to describe our fight with evil.
How about onward Christian soldiers?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Now, again, not exactly for those of us who are against war, and especially against Republican-instigated wars. It's obviously not a favorite metaphor of ours, but I think we're looking at it from the cultural perspective of conservative evangelicals and Pentecostals, that's not to be too awfully surprised, you know, when we see it being displayed. So, again, I appreciate what Mike's trying to do, but I think he's shooting in the wrong direction, and I would appreciate it if he spent more time analyzing the curriculum for middle school and above.
Well, Martin is talking about Mike Papantonio, who is the host of a show called Ring of Fire with Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and is the counterpoint, and I guess he's a Christian as well, the counterpoint to these right-wing evangelicals that are in this film, Jesus Camp, which I would highly recommend. All right, Martin, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Here's Bill. Bill is in Berkeley. Bill, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter. It's great to talk to you again.
Well, thank you.
I just wanted to bring up a point and see if you had a comment on it. It seems like with everything boiling down on the Republicans, all these scandals of every stripe and sort, it seems that in the past your so-called gun rights people or NRA people, all those sort of people that lean toward, you know, almost kind of a militia type attitude, all of those folks seem to really hate and despise Bill Clinton based on the premise that he represented taking away their rights in every possible way, that it was almost like going to be a dictatorship if Bill Clinton were to have his way. And now, in the face of Bush's recent, you know, changing of the laws, getting rid of habeas corpus, where are these people now, those who fought so vehemently against Clinton on that topic? Where are these people now? How do they feel? Why aren't we hearing from them as Bush has taken away more rights than any Democrat would have ever dreamed of doing? Could you comment on that?
Yeah, well, Bill, certainly a lot of there are a lot of far, far right people. They see that as very, very dangerous. There's a site called, I've mentioned this before and I always forget which it is, antiwar.com or antiwar.org, that is a right-wing libertarian site. And even I always block on his name too. It's offensive to me to even sort of name these people, that has been critical of Bush on the war and other things. Yeah, you think they would be out there. I mentioned before, they had these, during the 90s, they had these bumper stickers, I love my country, but I fear my government. Where are they now? What do? Take them off their trucks? Why don't they fear their government now when that there's camps being built under under contracts? Let me see if I can quickly go to my site. Peter Werbe, PETERWERBE.com. American prison camps are on the way. Let's see. This is this is from a reputable site. Sometimes I put stuff on there that's just out there to be provocative, and because a lot of times turns out to be true. Other times, most times does. I mean, I'm really into having it being accurate. This thing ever comes up. By the way, we have some open lines for you. 313-298-WRIF. I think it's going to take a minute to open. So let me just tell you about another issue that I think is extraordinarily important, and it's Walmart. What's Walmart doing? The voting power of Walmart's huge U.S. workforce has become the latest target in the retailer's battle with union critics as labor activists launch a drive to reach Walmart workers ahead of the midterm elections just this month. By the way, I don't know if I can. Where was that thing with the vote totals? Man, stuff is hard to keep track of. But they do these the different places at which they do. Here it is. Let me see if it says it on here. Get this. Well, married respondents. This is Bush's poll ratings, which are down the drain. While married respondents, a part of Bush's political base, remained steady at 42% positive in his latest survey, which is better than overall, another demographic that has strongly supported him in the past, weekly Walmart shoppers. People that shop at Walmart regularly tend to support Bush, turned more negative. Just 43% gave him positive marks in the latest poll, down from 55% 3 weeks ago. Now, what is up with this? Then, among those shoppers, 57%, oh no, now, among those shoppers, 57% give him negative job marks. But pretty much so that Walmart is mostly working class and poor people that go there. Why in the world would they be supporting these billionaires that are making conditions for the poor and for workers worse? But what Walmart is worried about is they might get unionized. Oh, man, how could they do business? I mean, think of the billions that these people make. The combined Walmart-Walton family fortune is more than Bill Gates. And yet they will close stores rather than allow it to unionize. Oh, well, man, they would probably go down the drain. Well, Costco is heavily unionized, maybe completely unionized, and they do just fine. And they give good wages, and they give good health benefits. So what is with these Walmart people, other than that they're just totally pathological? You know, they could live I forgot what the total of their fortune is, but like $50 billion or something like that. So, and there's five of them. So say they gave away $4.5 billion to set up the most, you know, the best wages and, you know, healthcare and daycare centers and all of that, and only wound up with $500 million. So they would only have $100 million in net worth apiece. Wow. How could they live on that? I mean, it is. It's pathological greed. Insanity. They would close a store, a Walmart outlet, rather than letting people that say, hey, look, we're being screwed real badly by the company. We want union representation. They are just totally whack. There's wakeupwalmart.com. Wakeupwalmart.com. Not to be confused with the store that sponsors these hours of Night Call. It's a group that started by the United Food and Commercial Workers to pressure Walmart to change, and it says it's going to contact Walmart workers and shoppers in multiple states with flyers, phone calls, and television ads. In the meantime, Walmart has launched a company-wide effort. Now, they got 1.3 million workers, and they want them to register to vote. I mean, this could come back and bite them in the butt. There's absolutely no doubt about that, because I can't believe that these Walmart workers, given that Walmart has just announced they're going to cut back, they're going to put caps on wages, they're going to put more and more part-time workers in positions so they don't have to give them the lousy health care benefits that some of them are eligible for, and on and on. But what they do is they announce to their workers, you know what this is? It's like the king or a local duke that tells the peasants, here are my enemies, deal with them accordingly, and the people carry out his wishes. Somebody just wrote in and talked, you know, that word you hear from time to time, sheeple. But one final thing. Here, I found it. American prison camps are on the way. This is on my website. Kellogg Brown and Root, a Halliburton subsidiary, is constructing a huge facility at an undisclosed location to hold tens of thousands of Bush's, quote, unlawful enemy combatants. Americans, this says, are certain to be among them. Oh, this is by Marjorie Cohn, who is a law professor and also maybe the president of the National Lawyers Guild. And you have to remember that this law that Debbie Stabenow, the Democratic senator from Michigan, voted for, also allows Bush and Rumsfeld to designate U.S. citizens as unlawful enemy combatants if they or we give direct or indirect support to terrorists. Now, these hideous Republicans have already indicated that anybody critical of the Bush racket is giving support to the terrorists. So, hey, I don't know. All right, let me just see if I'm right about Marjorie Cohn here. Might take too long to do. It is. All right. More when we come back. This is Night Call. I'm Peter Werby. 313-298-WRIF. 313-298-9743.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riff rock.
The way you want it.
See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Super Tuesday on 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
This is WRIF.com.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thanks. Welcome back to our final segment of call-in. And you can join us, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Let's go to Ray Ray's in Rochester Hills. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Doing great.
Hey, listen, when you listen to the propaganda that is being propagated by the Bush administration, and you consider the crimes against the Constitution and the American people that administration has committed, where are the detractors? They're gone. You were talking about the NRA folks. It is a great example of what is wrong, not only with the Republican message, but on another level, I mean, as a lifelong Democrat, the Democratic Party, I think, has still failed to unify itself and come up with a solid message. I mean, the Republicans, for all their warts, have been consistent. I mean, they've been consistently wrong with the message that they've been delivering, but it's been consistent.
No,
so
I know.
They have this loyal group that, as misguided as they are, they've been continuing to get the same dogma from that party for years, and I think that part of the problem is that the Democrats continue. We don't have a strong central leadership. We don't have the type of message that is necessary to bring in the outliers that I think could turn the tide. And I think that's how we've lost the last two elections.
Well, I think we lost the last two elections by having them stolen from us, but they were narrow enough that by suppressing votes and rigging machines and getting getting Bush's dad's buddies on the court to declare him the president, but they are too narrow. And yeah, I think that people vote against the Republicans. I don't think that there's any sense of this positive. There are in local elections. I mean, if you listen to Tony Trupiano in the 11th district, if you listen to Nancy Skinner in the 9th district, and some of these Dems across the country, you go, whoa. But when you start getting up towards the leadership, now here, and I saw this before, this is an email that Joe from Canton wrote in. Said when Nancy Pelosi, the House Democratic Party leader, was interviewed on 60 Minutes, a subject was brought up about impeachment, and Pelosi said she wouldn't take the initiative to get Bush impeached. She said there's more pressing issues to deal with. And Joe says, I want him impeached, and I don't want to see him in office till 2009. But doesn't Nancy ever watch, like, poker on television? I mean, what happened to the idea of at least holding cards that you're not showing, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, the Democrats haven't played any brinkmanship at all.
No.
And that's part of the problem. I think the general populace, you know, the Walmart workers, I think they would respond in kind to a stronger message and a stronger sense of unity from the Democratic Party.
Well,
we allow the Republicans to ride roughshod based on the virtue of the unity of their message. They feel that, I think the general populace feels that the Republicans have their game together better than the Democrats, even though the game in the long term is going to be detrimental to their well-being.
Well, I forgot. I just saw these figures somewhere. Actually, there's articles in Counterpunch.org. Good site. And they were talking about how far to the right of the Democratic rank and file is the whole leadership. That overwhelmingly, the Democrats and many independents want a date set for when we are exiting Iraq. And yet, the Democratic leadership has done everything possible to make sure that centrist and center-right Democrats are the ones that have won elections or the primaries by funneling money to them and away from people that would have energized the base, as they say. So, I don't know. I mean, I voted. I couldn't even bring myself. I'd say I voted absentee already. I couldn't even bring myself to vote for Stabenow. I voted for the Green candidate. And people were horrified. Oh, God, you want Bouchard in there? You want? I thought you wanted the Democrats, to take the Senate. Republicans need to be punished for everything awful they've done to America in the world in the last 6 years under this Bush racket. But I'm just not going to be blackmailed. And that's the strategy. Hey, what are they going to do? Vote for Bouchard? They got to vote for me no matter how opportunistic I am. And I just couldn't eat it, actually.
Well, if we don't get the word out, we're going to be looking at another 4 years. And you know what? The country can't afford it. We'll be bankrupt. We'll be in another war. And, the hopes for recovery are will be bleak at best.
It lessens more and more. Thank you, Ray. I appreciate your call. Now, did I mention last week that a program that the Democrats could have put forth was withdrawal from Iraq? Bush can deal with that. He's the commander in chief. But that could be the call. You figured out how to get us in, buddy. You figure out how to get us out without killing thousands more Iraqis and hundreds of more Americans. But take that money, those hundreds of billions of dollars that have already been spent. Well, I mean, can't do that because that's already gone to Halliburton and Carlyle Group and Raytheon and all these other corporations that are just benefiting richly off of our tax dollars. But we're not going to spend another $300 billion to give to Halliburton. We're going to spend it on a national health program. We're going to spend it on an infrastructure rebuilding. And will they do it? I don't think so. Well, here's what the grand old party's going to do. They're going to begin airing these ads, and they may have already had, that warns of more cataclysmic terror attacks against the U.S. homeland if the Democrats are elected. The ad portrays Osama bin Laden and quotes his threats against America dating back to February 1998. These are the stakes, the ad concludes. Vote November 7th. Now, of course, the deal is that Osama bin Laden, that the warning was already in. I mean, one of the things that Cheney says, well, we've done a heck of a job protecting the American people. Well, that's what they're supposed to do. They didn't do it between January 20th, 2001, and September 11th, 2001. They totally dropped the ball. They allowed us to get hit in a manner that the American territory of America has never been hit before. The fact that they're doing their job now, well, talk about shutting the barn door after the horse is gone. But in the meantime, this is being used and manipulated in order to scare us. All right, I want to hear this call. Here's Sandy from Taylor. Sandy, hi. It's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
I just want to say that I support Debbie Stabenow, and I believe a lot of your callers calling in against Stabenow are not disgruntled Democrats, but hacks for Sheriff Bouchard.
Oh, you know what, Sandy? I think you are completely 100% wrong. What do you say about me? Am I a hack for Bouchard? I didn't vote for her.
Okay, well, I'm not saying you, but I'm saying that because Debbie Stabenow is running against a sheriff,
yeah,
our free media would slice, dice, fry, and fricassee her if she didn't vote for that military commissions bill. And I'd like you to fast forward to if we ever get a vote on the Iran war. Debbie Stabenow, no. Sheriff Bouchard, yes.
You know, you're absolutely right. I mean, I know you're right on that, but
can we afford this? Do you want to vote for yes for the Iran war? Then keep on voting for the Green Party or for Bouchard.
But what you're talking about, this is the kind of blackmail that the Democrats have been practicing on their constituents for forever.
I don't really think it's whatever you said. I think it's strategy. They have to get in before they can do anything.
Well, I think it's opportunistic strategy, but I'm not completely unsympathetic to what you're saying.
We can have a vote yes for the Iran war, and that's Bouchard.
All right, thank you, Sandy. That's a good point. I appreciate it. Yeah, but as I said, I think you're absolutely 100% wrong characterizing these people that have called in as sort of, what would you call it, stealth Bouchard voters. 313-298-WRIF. Shelby is listening in Pittsburgh, and she writes in, Nancy Pelosi said she would not initiate impeachment herself. She never said she would block impeachment initiated by another House member, say John Conyers. By the way, Tony Trupiano, running in the 11th district, is an impeachment candidate. He says that he, I think, will initiate that, and he is supported by impeachpack.org, impeachpack.org. But I don't know. I mean, it's all sort of weaselly. Nancy Pelosi, she would not initiate, but she wouldn't block it either. I mean, how about most political parties all across the world have a program. They have a program. So, for instance, I was just talking a second ago about how in this last desperate move, in order to not go down to ignominious defeat, that the Republicans are going to play the terror card. And I wonder what's going to happen. Are they, because of a terror, if they let another terror incident occur, it's not going to, that won't work for them, will it? Because they're supposed to be our great protectors. So I haven't seen this ad. Anybody see the ad? Is this run? They said it was going to be on cable. The Democratic National Committee Communications Director Karen Finney said this is a pathetic move by an increasingly desperate GOP. Clearly, Republicans are so afraid of their abysmal record, they can't offer one example of what they've done to keep America safe. Yeah. Also, there was that incident where this guy went on the internet and did this posting and said there that all these stadiums over this weekend were going to be targets for either terror bombings or al-Qaeda bombings or something like that. And I'm thinking, why are they announcing this? Why is this a public announcement? Doesn't this just add fuel to the fear factor it would be like every time that the police found out that there was like criminals going to plan something but they broke it up, they would make these big announcements. Cops prevent a lot of crimes. They prevent it by patrolling, they catch people in the act, stuff like that, and it's not a big item. So why? I mean, this serves political purposes. This absolutely serves political purposes. All right. You can call. Let me see. Do we have some time? Yeah, we have some time. If you want to grab some phones right now, we have some open lines, and we can grab some in the last minutes remaining. 313-298-WRIF. At 1 a.m., which is just in about 13 and a half minutes or so, we're going to be interviewing I don't know why I always say that plural. I will be interviewing Scott Ritter, the former Marine, former advisor to First Gulf War General Norman Schwarzkopf, and UN weapons inspector in Iraq. We're going to talk to him about his new book, Target Iran, what Sandy from Taylor was talking about. And then after that, well, I forgot what the next... I can't believe that I just did it. Must be something. Oh, yeah. Very good. About surveillance cameras. All right, let's go to John. John is in Holland. All across the state, that Holland, Michigan, tulips and all that?
Yeah, Holland, Michigan tulips.
Yeah. What's up? Go ahead.
Hey, I was just wondering. I just tuned in, and I just heard you talking about how they should have done more before 9/11.
Right.
Were you talking about the Bush campaign?
Yeah.
I was wondering. There's two movies that I've seen about that whole 9/11 thing. One's called Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
It's mistaken with Fahrenheit, but it's Fahrenheit 9/11.
Okay.
And that was put out by Al Gore's campaign manager and the chief of staff for Bill Clinton. It was to combat Michael Moore's movie.
Now, you're mixing up a lot of stuff. There's a right-wing movie that is that attacks Michael Moore's movie, but it certainly wasn't done by those folks that you mentioned.
No, yeah, I know what you're saying. No, this was actually put out by those two people.
It wasn't.
Hey, John,
it was not. Absolutely was not.
In that movie, Bill Clinton's chief of staff says, I love how Bill Clinton handled his presidency, but the only thing that he didn't do right is we knew where Bin Laden was, and we knew they were meeting on what was going to happen on 9/11, and he called off the strike. That's what he says in that movie.
You know what? You're confusing this with that docudrama that was total crap that ran on ABC. So, I mean, this is fiction, and everybody involved in that denies that. All right, thanks a lot. Here is Jerry. Jerry, where are you calling from? Jerry? Jerry left. All right, that was our last caller. Thank you very much for listening. Thanks for calling. And stay tuned for our interviews. I think you're going to find them pretty interesting.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Yeah.
Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you. We keep talking about an October surprise. A number of friends of mine think it's going to be an attack on Iran. I don't know if it's going to happen before the election, but Iran is definitely in the bomb sights of George W. Bush and his administration. Joining me is Scott Ritter. He has written the book Target Iran, The Truth About the White House's Plans for Regime Change, and that means not in the U.S., but in Iran, obviously. Scott Ritter has been on the Peter Werby Show before. He was one of the U.N.'s top weapons inspectors in Iraq between 1991 and 1998. Before working for the U.N., he served as an officer in the U.S. Marines and as a ballistic missile advisor to General Norman Schwarzkopf during the first Gulf War. We interviewed him about his book, Iraq Confidential, but he's also written Endgame and Frontier Justice. He lives in New York State, where we're reaching him. Scott Ritter, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, the book, of course, and it's hard to just summarize in one sentence, but what do you think about the possibility of an attack on Iran before the elections?
No, I don't think so. I mean, something very dramatic would have to happen in terms of, you know, a revelation backed with fact that demonstrated Iran to be a threat to the national security of the United States of such magnitude and urgency that the Bush administration, you know, felt compelled to respond. The bottom line is, you know, an attack against Iran is a very dangerous undertaking. It's one that will have immediate consequences to the United States. They'll be felt by all Americans, primarily economically, when the oil supplies are shut down and oil prices go through the roof. So it doesn't make any sense for the Bush administration to move on Iran before the election, because it's not going to be over quickly. There will be a price to pay, and that may not translate well at the polls. The other reality is that the Bush administration hasn't done the preparatory work necessary for a military strike. A military strike is not going to be a one-time deal. You know, bomb them one day, it's over with. It's going to be a sustained aerial bombardment, possibly backed up by, you know, some limited number of troops on the ground. And this, we're talking about something that's going to take months to unfold, which means the Bush administration needs to undertake, you know, a global diplomatic initiative to secure international support, primarily in the form of basing rights in the region where we will deploy our military forces. Some of this preparatory work has been done. It is not complete. And, you know, that would need to take place, and that's not going to happen before the election. The other thing is there has to be preparatory work done here at home. The Bush administration has been engaging in this, you know, propagandizing where they demonize Iran for some time now, and it's very easy. With a gentleman named Ahmadinejad as president, he continues to provide sound bites that, that support and sustain the demonization process. But this is not a dictatorship here in America, regardless of what some on the left say. The president still needs to go to Congress and get congressional support for this action. This has not occurred. And finally, it's the military themselves. This is not something that one carrier battle group is going to accomplish. A lot of people have been focused on the movement of the USS Eisenhower into the Middle East, saying, aha, look, the October surprise. Look, if they moved all the carrier battle groups in the U.S. arsenal into the Middle East and started shifting all the bomber wings and all the fighter wings, then I'd say, hey, something's afoot. But that hasn't happened. So yeah, I'm not worried about an October surprise. I am worried, however, that the Bush administration intends to attack. And I think that the window for such an attack opens sometime in March 2007. That means between November and March, the Bush administration will do everything that I just outlined. But then it's like preparing a football team for the Super Bowl. If you don't use them, you lose all your skills. Mm-hmm. So the window shuts in June. And the danger here is that once that window shuts, it's like hitting the reset button. The Bush administration needs to go back and redo all of its preparatory work. And that'll be very difficult. You know, with the next Congress coming in, with the likelihood that it might be a Democratic Congress, I think so obstacles could be put in place. So I think there's a political reality that has to be dealt with, that Bush has one chance and one chance only to accomplish his desire of solving the Iran problem before he leaves office. And that chance comes between March and June of 2007.
Well, Scott Ritter, you just recently returned from a trip to Iran. I think that may surprise some people. Can we just get on a plane and fly over to Tehran?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The cake. I mean, getting a visa is tough for if you're someone like me with a high profile, and the Iranians are scratching their head saying, do we really want to let this guy in? But you'd be surprised. There's a huge number of American tourists that go to Iran. It's a very beautiful country with tons of culture, tons of history, and extraordinarily pro-American. You're treated like royalty when you arrive. Everybody's like, an American. Yeah, well, hey, thank you for coming to our country.
Hmm.
You know, we hear that, you know, you guys are beating us up. You think so poorly of us. Thanks for coming and checking it out yourself. And the other thing that struck me about Iran is that, yes, it's a theocracy. Yes, there's some conservative elements, and I'm sure there's a police state out there somewhere. I didn't see it. I've been in Middle East dictatorships. I've seen the oppressive nature of these regimes. And in Iran, I had full freedom of movement to go anywhere I want, talk to whomever I want, take a picture or whatever I wanted. I never had someone come up and say, hey, stop that, or, you know, bring me in for questioning. The other thing is, in a closed society, what you don't want is freedom, a free flowing of information. Yes, the Iranian government has shut down newspapers. Yes, they control the state press. But, you know, there's satellite television dishes all over the place where the Iranian people are watching BBC International, CNN, other Western outlets. Everybody has a cell phone. It's just like America. They have cell phones, and they're text messaging. It's the free flow of information, and they all have Internet access. It's an Internet-crazy country where they can download anything they want from the Internet and then share it amongst each other. So this is a very modern, westernized, pro-West and surprisingly pro-American country, and we're just not getting that picture when we tune into television here at home.
And the area is huge. I was looking at the map the other day, and Iran is about the size of all of Western Europe.
Yeah, it's a big country, 70 million people, nearly three times the size of Iraq. You know, anybody who thinks that we can just, you know, get one on the cheap here, go in and remove the theocracy and you know, score a victory for Uncle Sam, is going to be disillusioned when the time comes to move in. Because if you think Iraq is a nightmare, you don't even know what a nightmare is until we invade Iran.
Well, Scott Ritter, I mean, much of what you said probably came as a surprise to people, particularly for someone who was in the Marines, somebody who was a weapons inspector in Iraq, someone who worked with General Norman Schwarzkopf, that you paint almost a good picture of Iran, whereas certainly the government and particularly President Ahmadinejad is portrayed as an implacable enemy of the United States with continuing denunciations of the West.
Well, you know, I'm not here to defend Ahmadinejad. He has to defend his own statements. I will say this, that, you know, we portray him as sort of some South Tehran bully who jumps up and says, you know, lunatic things. He has said some pretty stupid things. His statement about Israel is unforgivable. The fact that he seeks to deny the Holocaust, again, unforgivable. But he's an academic, and if you know anything about Iran's academic system, it produces sharp people. Iran has the highest percentage of Middle Eastern scholars who have prepared PhD theses that have been peer-reviewed globally. I'm not talking about a closed society in Iran. I'm talking about throwing it out there for the world to take a look at, and the world says, these guys are good. They're smart. So Ahmadinejad's a product of this academic system. He was a teacher, so I think we need to at least give him that. That doesn't mean that we agree with what he says, but don't for a second think he's stupid. But the other problem I have with Ahmadinejad is that we sit there and you know, broadcast everything he says. We put a spotlight on him. And, of course, he's a poster child for demonization with some of the things he says. But I ask people to shift from his mouth and move to his finger and take a look at what buttons he can push. He can't push the police button. Constitutionally, he doesn't have any police power. He can't push the military button. Constitutionally, he has no military power. He can't push the foreign policy button. He doesn't control that either. He doesn't control the nuclear program. In fact, he controls nothing. He can sign legislation, he can sign treaties, but the processes that create legislation and create treaties are out of his control. He's a figurehead only. The real power resides with somebody called the Supreme Leader, the Ayatollah Khamenei, the Guardian Council, the Expediency Council. This is where the power resides in Iran. But if you turn on American TV, you wouldn't know that the way we show Ahmadinejad all over the place. You know, in 2003, the Supreme Leader in the Guardian Council reached out to the United States through the Swiss Embassy. We talk about Ahmadinejad saying he wants to burn, you know, remove Israel off the face of the map. In 2003, the Supreme Leader asked George Bush to sit down in one-on-one negotiations between the United States and Iran, where they would talk about the normalization of relations between the United States and Iran, the creation of a peace treaty, a peace settlement between Israel and Iran, inclusive of a solution to the Hezbollah problem in South Lebanon, and Iran was willing to put its nuclear power program on the table. This was rejected by the Bush administration because this is a process that would lead to the legitimization of the theocracy that Bush has sworn to eliminate. But if we want to talk about dealing with the Iranians, stop talking about Ahmadinejad. He has no power. Talk about the real power brokers. And when Bush says he's pushing for a diplomatic solution, I'll believe it when he puts Condoleezza Rice on an airplane and sends her to Tehran and she sits down with the Supreme Leader and his representatives. Then I'll say that is diplomacy.
Scott Ritter is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. The brand new book from Scott is Target Iran, the truth about the White House's plans for regime change. You can go to nationbooks.org. It's published by Nation Books. You can also go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com, and link up from there. Scott Ritter, the other thing, of course, and we've lost it a little here, my fault, as asking the questions, is the whole idea of Iran developing nuclear weapons and the way in which oftentimes, although the man who we're not going to talk about anymore frames things, is that one at least gets the idea that that there's a possibility that they could be involved in production. For one thing, the idea is if you don't have nuclear weapons, like Iraq, you get invaded. If you do have them, like North Korea, they want to negotiate with you. So it would almost, on the face of it, make sense if Iran was developing nuclear weapons.
Well, except for this reality. Let's keep in mind this. The North Korean government declared that it had a nuclear weapons program. The North Korean government said they're going to make a nuclear bomb, and they did so. They did so after they withdrew from the Non-Proliferation Treaty, after they kicked out the inspectors. They did nothing to break the law, but the world has condemned it, rightly so. But at least they were up front saying this. And they've been up front for some time. The Iranians have said they have no intention of having a nuclear weapon. Not only that, remember, this is an Islamic republic that takes its religion seriously. And the theocrats have issued a fatwa or religious edict that says nuclear weapons are inconsistent with Islam, and that they cannot have nuclear weapons, they will not have nuclear weapons, and they've committed publicly to not having this program. Now, people say, well, they could just be saying that, blowing smoke, etc. Okay, but they've committed down that path. And now what's important is if they ever do divert and decide to pursue a nuclear weapons program, we're going to discover it early on. I mean, you can't hide these things. Now, regardless of what people say about underground bunkers hiding, no. We now, thanks to the work of the International Atomic Energy Agency, have done a complete survey of Iraq's program. We've done a material balance, an accounting for centrifuges, an accounting for critical equipment. We know where it is. We have it cataloged. We've done a survey of the atmosphere, of the environment. We've isolated nuclear isotopes. So in the future, if Iran is to pursue a nuclear weapons program, it would either have to withdraw from the NPT and therefore kick all inspectors out, which is a clear signal that they've shifted gears, and now we have the reason to say, oh, maybe they're working on a nuclear weapon. Or they'd have to do it in secret, and if they do it in secret, they're going to get caught. And if they get caught, we're going to catch it too early for them to have a weapon that can stop an invasion. And all it does is legitimize the concerns of the Bush administration. So let's start with the reality. The reality is there is no evidence out there whatsoever to sustain the Bush administration's allegations that Iran is pursuing a nuclear weapons program. There's nothing but speculation, rhetorically laced speculation. But the inspection regime, while it says they can't disprove that one might exist here, there, or somewhere, says that in their exhaustive survey inspections of Iran, they have found nothing to sustain the notion that there is a weapons program in place.
Well, why then is, like, the European Union, some of those countries that don't have the kind of belligerency inherent in their foreign policy as the U.S. does under Bush, why do they seem to have the same concerns about Iran developing nuclear weapons?
Well, it's one of the things that I've covered in the book quite well, actually. It's a great chapter called The Great Appeasers, and it talks about the European Union, the European Commission, and the role that they played. Interestingly, when they stepped in the aftermath of the invasion of Iraq, if you recall, in the build-up to the invasion of Iraq, the European Union, old Europe, according to Rumsfeld, was against going to war. It was America's deft political maneuvering to expand NATO, bring in the new Eastern European democracies, and threaten to split the European Union at a time that it was expanding, to divide NATO. You know, the United States played some power politics, put it all on the table, and Europe caved. And Europe caved on Iraq, and then afterwards Europe felt really bad about it. So Europe intervened diplomatically early on in the Iranian crisis. And what's interesting, in November 2003, they signed something called the Tehran Declaration. And that declaration basically, Iran said, look, we will suspend uranium enrichment. We will agree to what's called the Additional Protocol of Inspections, a more intrusive regime of inspections. But the Europeans committed to something that's very critical. They said Iran has a right under Article 4 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty to enrich uranium. That's a critical thing. So what basically was happening is the suspension was to take place until which time a new inspection regime could be brought into play. Now, that new inspection regime came into play. The Iranians are looking around going, all right, guys, we got the inspectors in. When can we lift the suspension? And now the Americans leaned on Europe, again, exploiting this divide between old Europe and new Europe. And the Europeans now caved and said, no, the suspension has to be indefinite, which means Europe no longer recognized Iran's right under Article 4 to enrich uranium. Now when the Iranians said, forget that, we're going to enrich, and they lifted the suspension unilaterally, Europe is jumping up down and screaming. But what they're screaming about is not a concern that Iran is developing nuclear weapons. They're screaming that Iran lifted the suspension that they had agreed to under the Tehran Declaration, despite the fact that Europe reneged on its guarantees. Mm-hmm. The Europeans do not believe Iran poses a threat. The Europeans have been placed under tremendous amount of diplomatic pressure by the United States, and right now are waging an argument against Iran that is legal and technical in nature and has nothing to do with weaponization.
Scott Ritter, let's go to the subtitle of your new book, Target Iran, The Truth About the White House's Plans for Regime Change. I mean, why isn't there something as madness as, or fanaticism, I guess it is that when you try something and it doesn't work, you redouble your effort or something like that?
The definition of insanity is keep doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result.
Okay, so.
We go into Iraq,
right,
doing regime change, and it's an abysmal failure.
A disaster. Worse, getting worse.
It's getting 10 times worse.
This last Tuesday, 10
American soldiers dead.
Yeah, yeah.
200 and some odd wounded in the past month. Not to forget the number of Iraqis that are dying on a daily basis in this horrific struggle that we created. But, okay, move on. Iran. Why would they want to hit the repeat button? When it went so bad. Remember, this is about ideology. This is about domestic American politics. We have an administration that has committed to a certain course of action. They have committed in writing. It's called the National Security Strategy of the United States. This is an administration that says, we stand firm against the war, against the terrorists. We're the ones that can best defend America. And they've articulated their plan of defense in this strategy, first in the 2002 edition, which embraced the notion of preemptive wars of aggression. That led to Iraq. Now, one would think if they had learned their lesson that the next version of the National Security Strategy that came out would say, hey, we want to rethink this one. Nope. The June 2006 version of the National Security Strategy says we were right to go into Iraq. Preemptive wars of aggression is the right course of action. And furthermore, this concept of regional transformation throughout the Middle East that involves regime change must be expanded. We need to go beyond Iraq to solve problems such as Iran, Syria, Lebanon, etc. And Iran is named 16 times in this document as representing the number one threat to the national security of the United States, not just in the form of a nuclear weapons program. The document says, even if Iran is not pursuing nuclear weapons, an odd thing to say when the administration has publicly said there is no doubt that they're pursuing nuclear weapons, but they say even if they're not pursuing nuclear weapons, they are a state sponsor of terror that cannot be allowed to continue to exist. So this administration has learned nothing from Iraq. It continues to pursue a policy of regime change in Iran that can only lead to military engagement between the United States and Iran that will end up, I predict, being orders of magnitude worse than the debacle we know as Iraq.
Well, Scott Ritter, you were a Marine, you were a weapons inspector in Iraq between 1991 and 1998, and perhaps most important for the question I'm going to ask, you were a ballistic missile advisor to General H. Norman Schwarzkopf in the first Gulf War. You know military thinking, and when, like, 2001 or so, people couldn't, I mean, you were like an oddity. Scott Ritter, an actual, you know, Marine who's against the Iraq War, now you're one of hundreds. And with the military, I mean, you know the military mind. You know the military brass mind. Is the military going to go ahead with this? Are they going to go for it?
Well, at the end of the day, the military has to obey the lawful orders given to them by the chain of command. The President of the United States is the commander-in-chief.
Sure.
Bad policy does not make it illegal policy.
Right.
The military is today trying to speak out. They are throwing up warning flags. But at the end of the day, when you sit down around the table and you say, hey, we don't have enough troops, and then the ideologues say, well, then plan action that doesn't involve occupation. Let's plan on an aerial bombardment. How can the military say no? So they put the plan forward. The administration says, we want to use nuclear weapons in the first strike. The military puts its foot down, says, no, we don't, we're not going to do that. That's absurd. That's illegal. And the National Command Authority withdraws the nuclear weapons, but now they keep the initial attack plan in place. Now the military's bought into the attack plan. The bottom line is, if the president gives the order, the military's going to salute and execute that order, even if they disagree with it.
Yeah, you know, and as what I was really getting to wasn't so much that formal chain of command, but you see now men that led divisions in Iraq speaking out publicly,
right.
And that's putting intense political pressure, even on electoral basis.
It's tough. I mean, maybe it is. I mean, look, the Democrats have Iraq in their pocket. You know, it's an issue that, you know, isn't going to help the Republicans in this coming election. Now, here's the problem with those generals. Let's take General Baptiste, who commanded, I believe, the 1st Infantry Division in Iraq. You know, he's out there now very critical. Well, you know, the problem is I can go back and pull up video clips of General Baptiste in Baghdad standing up before the collective media parroting the administration's line. The man has no credibility, because if this is truly what he believes, based upon beliefs that he held while he was the commander, then he should not have been parroting the line. He had a dereliction of duty, and that's the problem. If you don't have the courage to speak up when the stars are planted firmly on your collar, then don't expect anybody to give you too much credibility when, after you resign and your pension safely put away in your bank, that you suddenly now find the courage to speak out. Too late, General. Too many of your men died, and I just don't buy it. I wish this man it had the courage to speak up when it counts. It doesn't count now. It's too easy now.
Scott Ritter, we actually only have about a minute and a half, and this is something that could take a while, so my apologies on this. But you mentioned the disastrous results of an attack on Iran, and particularly economically, but it would talk about that briefly. Also, the military consequences. This is not an army of dust like the Saddam's army that barely existed.
Now, the first thing to understand is that the Iranians have a viable military, a large military, a well-trained military, and a very capable military, and it's not going to roll over and play dead. They've been studying the American way of war, and they know what to expect, and they've adapted to it. So we're going to have to wage a sustained struggle. Again, in a stand-up fight, we win every time. The problem comes economically. You know, right now we operate at 1.5% margin excess production capacity. You take Iranian oil off the market, you go to -4%. Iran shuts down the Straits of Hormuz, shut down Saudi oil production, Kuwaiti oil production, as they're very capable of doing. And you now have like -20%. That means that the world cannot produce enough oil to feed the addiction to oil. When that happens, the global economy grinds to a halt, hyperinflation kicks in, and this will happen nearly instantaneously to our invasion. We don't have enough strategic reserves to ride this thing out. So, You know, this will be a disaster. And again, we could bring back the nuclear weapon issue. The United States isn't going to sit there and let the economy collapse because the Iranians are offering stiff resistance. And while we may not use nuclear weapons in the initial strike, if we get bogged down, I bet you we use it in the follow-up. And when that happens, you've uncorked the nuclear genie, and it's like opening Pandora's box. You just don't know where that's going to take us.
Scott Ritter, 30 seconds. What do we do? Vote? We go to demonstrations? We go to meetings? We go to rallies? We sign petitions?
You know, right now in the short term, as a conservative Republican, I would say every American needs to go out and vote Democratic in the next election, because it doesn't mean you have to support the person or support the policies. We need friction in Congress. We need Congress to stand up and start acting in accordance with the system of checks and balances. And if we get friction, if we get a democratically controlled House that has oversight powers and they start asking the tough questions and demanding answers, we might get the friction necessary to stop the Bush administration's mad rush to armed conflict with Iran.
All right, got to check this book out, Target Iran, The Truth About the White House's Plans for Regime Change. Scott Ritter is the author, R-I-T-T-E-R. You can go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, or nationbooks.org. Scott Ritter, a pleasure to talk to you, and thank you for this clarion call.
Well, thank you, sir, for having me on your show.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days, every 6 months, for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in a contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220. This is WRIN.com. We'll be right back.
with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. I just saw a news item the other day how the Chicago mayor, Richard Daley, said he's going to put a surveillance camera on every corner, and they showed a photograph of the cameras, the prototype of what they're going to have on there. And emblazoned on every one was Chicago Police Department, and I thought, Big Brother is watching you. Well, camera surveillance, both here and in Europe, is growing considerably. There's great objection to it as well. One person, as part of a group, is joining us. His name is Bill Brown. He's part of the New York Surveillance Camera Players. And all of their, well, we'll get into all that they've done, but the book is We Know You Are Watching, The Surveillance Camera Players, 1996 to 2001. It's published by Factory School. You can go to factoryschool.org. Joining us from New York is Bill Brown. Bill, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you very much, Peter. I'm glad you have me.
There is so much in here. I was almost thinking of reading the summary here that comes from the factoryschool.org website. But it says that the surveillance camera players are America's foremost anti-surveillance camera group and documents so much of what you've done. Tell us about the group and tell us about your objection to surveillance.
I'll be happy to. The Surveillance Camera Players were formed here in New York in November of 1996, in part because that was the period in which then-Mayor Giuliani was reversing a 25-year-old New York City policy of not having police cameras installed in public places. Giuliani thought that he had a better idea, and in response to that initiative, the Surveillance Camera Players performed for the first time on December 10th, 1996. And the book, as you mentioned, documents 10 years of our activity to basically put this issue in front of people. Generally, they hear about it in the newspaper or on television, but there isn't a good opportunity for discussion. And hopefully that's what the Surveillance Camera Players do, is give an opportunity for people to discuss the changes that are taking place in almost every major urban area in the United States and throughout the world.
Well, Bill Brown, you just said performance. Most people would think it's at meetings, hearings, demonstrations. Tell us about performances, and why are you guys called the Surveillance Camera Players?
Well, we call ourselves the Players because we actually produce plays in front of publicly installed surveillance cameras. Generally, they are police cameras. And we found that this was a very direct way of both reaching the watchers, because we're standing in their line of sight, and also because these cameras are installed in heavily trafficked areas here in Manhattan, bystanders will see us. And this allows us to speak directly to both the watchers and our fellow Americans, rather than going through the mediation of meetings, council people, and political action. And we have found that this way of reaching right to people has been very, very effective. So we started out making performances, and that happened pretty much once a month for many, many years. And we still perform on occasion, I should mention, even though the group has switched activities largely towards our walking tours, which are based upon the maps that we make. What we found when we were performing in the early days is we'd hand out a simple flyer, just telling people who we were and why we were there. And we found it was even better, more suggestive, not to simply point to a single camera on a single street corner, but to make maps of that entire neighborhood and hand that out during the performances. And that's, again, part of our direct effort to simply educate the public. Everybody knows that there are surveillance cameras, but I don't think people have an idea of how many there are or what they look like. And that's what the walking tours now do. We've been doing that every single weekend for 6 years, and that has in some ways taken the place of our performances, even though the walking tours are themselves a type of performance, but they're not done by actors, but just whoever shows up to that walking tour on that particular day.
Now, the surveillance cameras are there to capture miscreants, malefactors, and other words that begin with M like that. And so you are being watched, so you're on television, essentially. There's the closed-circuit television cameras. Is there a reaction from the watchers? Does this signal then the men in blue come out and hassle you or watch you, or do they respond? How do they respond? Have you ever gotten a response?
We get lots of responses, and we actually work our way up through the hierarchy. So if we stand in front of a building with a surveillance camera, typically a security guard or the owner will come out, and depending on what play we're performing, they'll either be entertained or offended. And sometimes the entertaining plays simply reassure the watcher, don't worry, everything's okay, we're just going to work, going shopping, going home, the usual activities. But when we display a sign that says, we know you're watching, mind your own business, then the guards or the watchers feel personally implicated. And sometimes these guards will then call the police, who will then show up and ask us the basic questions. Who are we and what are we doing?
And who's your leader? Who's the spokesperson?
I tend to be
No, that's what they always ask.
Oh, that's correct. And that a very good strategy, especially because we are silent performers, mind you, is that we don't answer any questions. We simply give them the flyer, which is self-explanatory. And what I found over 10 years of performing in New York City is the police are very well-informed about us and often seem to scold the security guards for calling them because of something as unimportant as a group of performers.
So they're never hostile? You don't get arrested, attacked, or anything like that?
No. We have been pushed out of certain locations. We've performed in very, very high-profile places like Rockefeller Center during the 2000 election when the election returns were coming in, and the guards or the police officers will ask us to keep moving. But no, we've never been arrested, mostly because it's very clear we're exercising our constitutionally guaranteed right to free speech. And once they've seen the group make these performances over several years, they realize we're not a front group for a camera-smashing organization or something like that.
Yeah.
And we've actually won their trust, I believe, because there's a lot of polarization that goes on between police and demonstrators or protesters, both of whom suspect the worst of each other. And what we've tried to do is show the police protesters are just like them. And then, indeed, I find that many police officers are opposed to surveillance cameras because they're afraid that the cameras will put them out of work.
That's amazing. The book is We Know You Are Watching, and it's written, it's the activities of the surveillance camera players. It documents their activities between 1996 and 2006. Joining me on the phone from New York City is Bill Brown, one of the players. Now, this strikes me partly as you know, having humor, since I laughed heartily just a second ago. On the other hand, this is very serious because you mention a constitutional right to free speech. Also embedded in the Constitution is a right of privacy from government intrusion. That's been the basis of any number of Supreme Court decisions, including Roe v. Wade. Now, the argument is, and we haven't even addressed this, is that there is crime. I mean, we can get the roots of crime are, well, I don't even think they're that complex, but they're big issues. Also, now there's, you know, the boogeyman of terrorism, and the idea that there's going to be a camera sort of watching all of us. So what if we don't have anything to hide, or they're just looking for people, you know, they don't care if you scratch your butt or, you know, or something like that, but they're looking for somebody that's going to assault me when I visit there, or you, Bill Brown, when you're walking down the street, or they're going to see somebody, you know, going, you know, hijacking a taxi cab or something. In these times, maybe this is just a good technological way in which to fight crime.
Well, at least those are the selling points,
yeah.
And you rehearse them very well. And we've examined these selling points carefully, and I think the best response that we've come up with over this period of time is that the cameras are frequently not watched. They simply go to tape or some sort of digital recording instrument, which means if there is a crime or an act of terrorism, there isn't an officer watching that monitor in real time with a radio hookup who can say, I think we ought to get some people down to, let's say, 4th Street and 6th Avenue. And in that way, the whole principle of surveillance has been turned on its head. Supposedly, it deters people or catches them in the act. But if you're not actually watching in real time, that's impossible. So what happens is you simply, if you're lucky, get evidence of the crime, and the tape then doesn't prevent the activity, it simply documents it later. And this, I think, came out very, very clearly during the London bombings of July 7th, 2005, in which a team of terrorists went through the one of the most highly surveilled areas in the world, which is the London subway system. And despite the fact that they were watched, despite the fact that they were filmed during their dry run, they were still able to explode their bombs and kill some 50 people and injure 500 more, which showed that the big hole in the surveillance apparatus is the suicide bomber. That is somebody who is not deterred or indeed may want to be captured on film for the purposes of martyrdom.
Hmm.
So then when it comes to terrorism, it seems that if it's really a dangerous city that we live in, whether it's Detroit or Chicago or New York or Washington, the principle would be is getting people on the street who can respond immediately rather than through this giant delay that a surveillance camera system sets up.
Well, explain the principle, and it's an old one, going back to the 18th century of panopticon, and then I that appears in your work, and I think I have a question about that. I mean, essentially, we're all under surveillance, right?
Yes. The principle of the panopticon seemed to be fairly ingenious, which is if there was a prison shaped in a circle with a watcher put in the middle, the prisoners would never be sure if they're being watched at any given time. And the bet was that they'd figure we're being watched at all times, therefore we will not commit crimes or do anything else. And I think this is psychologically naive, because if you think about this in terms of poker, some players, if you put 10 chips into the middle of the table and say, I have 10 surveillance cameras, weak players will fold.
Mm-hmm.
But strong players will suspect it's a bluff and will try to call it. And it seems the bluff calling is a big part of criminal activity to begin with. People who either enjoy the thrill of trying to get away with something or something like that. So then surveillance has another hole, which is not only the suicide bomber, but somebody who's a game player and says, I suspect you're bluffing, and I'm going to try and do this anyway and see if I get away with it. If the cameras are not being monitored in real time and they get away with it that first or second time, they prove to themselves that the cameras are not really watching them, and it almost empowers them to do more crime.
Well, I was thinking in terms I mentioned earlier, Bill Brown, about the Chicago situation where, like London, there would be just this proliferation of cameras. And what you said earlier about that it's impossible for there to be humans watching every monitor on every street at every moment. If everyone's being watched, at some point it's almost like no one's being watched.
That's right. Apparently, there's a billion hours of surveillance footage generated every year in the United States.
Wow.
And unless we turn 50% of the American people into watchers, watching the other 50%, we'll never have enough manpower, as they say, to watch all of these images.
Well, at worst, then, it seems like a waste of money. Why? I mean, I don't like the idea of being under surveillance, because even if it's under tape, if I'm going to pick my nose, I'll leave the butt out of this, I guess, I'm not real comfortable with being surveilled through a camera, but one could argue, well, we live in tense times with a lot of potential dangers, so what? At worst, the worst thing so far that we've said about it is that it's inefficient, but it's the old thing. Why, if you don't have anything to hide, what's the difference if your phone's being tapped or the cops come into your house or 100 other little intrusions by government like that?
Right. It's hard to answer a question like this without seeming hysterical, but I'll try to do so.
Okay.
A classic example is the French government in about 1939 or 1940 created health department roles of every homosexual man and woman in France. And this was done presumably for the purposes of public health. But what happened was that when the French government fell and the Nazis took over and created their own regime in France, they inherited those what we would call databases, names and photographs of suspect people. So inadvertently, the French government created a list of people to be rounded up and placed in concentration camps. So the point being that even though right now we may be confident that our government is amassing large amounts of information on us and is not using it nefariously, this doesn't preclude something really unexpected or terrible happening in America, and we've created the infrastructure for an incredibly powerful totalitarian society.
That doesn't really do what it's even set up to do, even in a non-totalitarian society. Bill Brown, tell us, I don't have your website up in front of me. I think it's the Not Bored website.
Notbored.org.
Yeah.
And then if you just click through the opening pages, you see a banner for surveillance camera players, and that brings you to a very large archives of photographs, scripts, news coverage, commentary, analysis, all the things that a website can hold very efficiently.
Tell us the quote at the top. That's what I was looking for, and I want to get into the – I want to get back to the book some, but tell us the quote at the top.
Yes. The quote may be a little out of date. It was then Police Commissioner Howard Safier saying on the radio in 1999, only those people who are suspicious of government, distrustful of all government, would distrust what the police were doing with surveillance cameras.
Yeah.
So it was an easy reversal to simply say, well, indeed, we maintain a healthy skepticism about our government. This is one of the founding ideas of American democracy. So therefore, we do have a right to be skeptical or even dubious about what they're doing with the surveillance cameras, because it's okay to be distrustful of your government. This is what keeps governments honest.
All right, let's go back to the book. The book is We Know You Are Watching. It's a compilation of the activities of America's foremost anti-surveillance camera group, and it's written by the surveillance camera players. Bill Brown is one of them in New York City. And so when you say, I mean, there's a lot of photographs. These are the photographs that would be that the people on the cameras would see because this, as you said earlier, this is where you were performing.
That's right.
Yeah. And there's quite a few of them in the scripts. I mean, so this is in a lot of ways a how-to manual as well as a documentation of your activities.
Yes. To my mind, I'm glad that you noticed it. I was looking at the first version of the Food Not Bombs book, and it also does the same thing, which is this is what we've been doing, and if you are excited by this idea, this is how you do it. And at the end of our book, there's a whole series of how to perform a play, how to make a map, how to organize a walking tour, mostly because we'd like to empower other people all over the country, if possible, to do the very simple things that we've done. And though they're simple, they seem to be effective in that almost single-handedly, the surveillance camera players have kept this issue, or rather a critical appraisal of this issue, in front of the public. So this allows me to illustrate the idea about America's foremost surveillance camera group. This sounds very impressive, but unfortunately, there are virtually no other anti-surveillance camera groups in America. There are, of course, the Civil Liberties Unions and the Electronic Privacy Information Center, but these groups are devoted to much larger issues. So strictly speaking, there's only one or two anti-surveillance camera groups in America, and by a process of elimination, the surveillance camera players end up being the foremost one. But that's not a position that we're comfortable with. We'd like to see groups like this proliferate all over the country.
Well, one of the things I was going to say, this is an incredibly interesting book, and it's so much of what we've talked about is in there, everything from a report of activities over 10 years. And yet, it hasn't, as you just said, it hasn't translated in any way to sort of a mass movement. And is that discouraging? Like, one would hope, of course, that in what do they call those things where everybody gets cell phones and they all show up in the same place and
yes, flash mob.
Flash mob. is, I mean, this could be like a flash mob event, yet it is pretty much of what they used to call like cadre activity. And Gaia bless you, you know, I don't have any problem with that. But, I mean, I just wonder, is it discouraging after a while that the effect of anything, camera surveillance has expanded?
Well, you're very perceptive, and I'd say for every moment of discouragement we've had a moment of encouragement as well. And this is simply, I believe, what it's like to try to work on an issue, just one issue, for a very long time, is one can't be impatient with the public response to it. 10 years in American history seems to be a lot, but really isn't. So surveillance camera players keep trying to gird ourselves for a longer and longer struggle, especially because this issue becomes one of the most important in American politics. And I think what's happening in Chicago really illustrates it. You mentioned it a couple of times. Mayor Daley has said that by 2016, there will be a surveillance camera on every city block in Chicago. And this has also been picked up by the mayor of Houston, who wants to do the same thing. And I'm not sure if they really understand the severity of what they're speaking of, which is a permanently installed system to watch everybody, whether they're innocent or guilty, potential criminals or potential crime victims. And this seems very, very indiscriminate. And it's also the precise time for people to raise their voices and say, I don't think that this is a particularly good idea. Not only because of its privacy implications, but as we said, we're not sure if this is actually keeping us safe.
Well, there's also a few budgetary concerns. I mean, just think about product and maintenance and the people that are going to be watching them. And who knows, why pay union-salaried cops to do it when you could probably get people to do it for, the Democrats that they get in Congress will pump the wage up to a magnificent $6.75 an hour. They'll get $6.75 an hour. People doing it'll be like the baggage inspection people prior to 911.
That's right. Absolutely right. The only way that Chicago or New York or Washington or these other cities can afford such massive systems is federal money. And that what's supposedly keeping us safe from terrorists is actually a large financial, and I mean tens of millions of dollars to install surveillance systems.
That's right. I think we should talk about, no one talks about millions anymore. That's what some of these guys have in their pockets from profits. We're talking billions. So we're talking about a military industrial security complex where their private wealth, what you and I earn every day, a part of it is transferred to this this war security productive apparatus as a way of driving the economy, except we get little back from it, except a bunch of cameras watching us.
That's right, especially because the camera developers, the people who program software applications for it, these are the very biggest either university or Department of Defense research institutions, and billions are spent in trying to solve the problem, which is what do you do with a billion hours of footage? And indeed, it's becoming a very large industry here in the United States, a kind of an outcropping of what you refer to as the industrial military complex, which is that a number of people can make a large amount of money by putting cameras on every single city street in almost every city of this country.
You know, Bill Brown, we're almost to the end of our conversation, and I want to say to people that are listening, the book we know you are watching, that Bill, one of the authors of, through the surveillance camera players, we've barely scratched the surface even in terms of topics. This is an incredible book, and again, I'll get you the web addresses, and you can go to my website, Peter Werbe. W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com, and either go to on-air guests or to books, and you'll find a link. And it's like $20, $24 if you get it through, I think, some of these book services, $20 if you get it directly, and a lot of illustrations as well. All right, let me get one of my last questions in. And is there been legal challenges to this? The cops can't just go through your door. They still need a warrant so far. Although, you know, the Constitution is being shredded pretty quickly these days. Has anything like the American Civil Liberties Union, I see Donna Lieberman from the New York Civil Liberties Union has wrote a nice endorsement of your book on the back of it. What about actual legal challenges to all this?
They're very slow in the making. They have to be done, at least here with the New York Civil Liberties Union, at the level of the city council, which means that laws have to be written that govern the use of surveillance cameras. And that sounds simple, but it's very, very complicated. And also, it's simply legalizing their use when it seems to me that these cameras exist in a legal vacuum, and it might be good to remove the cameras before we change the laws, rather than changing the law simply to admit that there are cameras everywhere, they've been installed semi-legally, and now they're there, and we just have to get used to them.
Bill Brown, thanks for being with us. Let me give the websites again. You can go to factoryschool.org/pubs/SCP. Those are always hard to get on the radio. You can go to my website, peterwerby.com, or you can go to notboard.org/the... what do they call it? -scp.html. Usually those are kind of hard to get, but you can go to my website. Greil Marcus, the wonderful author of Lipstick Traces, says the surveillance camera players are not watching you. They are watching the cameras because we have forgotten to. The cameras can't understand what the SCP are doing, but we can. The cameras don't smile, but you might. This is a wonderful book. We know you are watching. Factoryschool.org is where you can find more about it. Bill Brown, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
My pleasure, Peter. Thank you.
Like a song you just heard?
Oh, yeah!
Listen up. Then head on over to the Digital Riff Music Store at WRIF.com and download your favorite riff tunes for just 99 cents.
Next song.
Stay connected. With 101 WRIF and WRIF.com. Everything that rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com. WRIF.com.
Hanging around downtown by myself, and I had so much time to sit down and think about myself, and then there she was, like double cherry pie. Yeah, there she was, like disco superfly. I smell sex and candy hair. Who's that lounging in my chair? Who's that casting the fear stares in my direction? Mama, this surely is a dream. Yeah. Yeah, mama, this surely is a dream. Dig it. Down by myself, and I've had too much caffeine, and I was thinking about myself, and then there she was, in platform double suede. Yeah, there she was, like disco lemonade. Yeah. I smell sex and candlelit hair. Who's that?
In the Motor City.
This is
Jay Hudson.
Jay Hudson.
There is none higher.
Jay Hudson.
Yow! Straight out of Detroit, baby.
Hell yeah, man.
Hey!
Score, score, score!
Oh, that sounds so sweet.
Jay Hudson, I love you.
Hey, you think KFC's still open?
I'm calling the shots! Consider me
Jay Hudson.
This is my fucking chocolate factory. You better...
Jay Hudson. Every single that works.